Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC. Who's who? Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etric and Arisia and Woody Winks.
Hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC. Who's who?
Hello, and welcome to the 16th episode of Who's Who in the DC Universe, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm one of your hosts, the Irredeemable Shag, and along with me, as always, is my co-host, the esteemed Rob Kelly. How you doing, buddy?
I don't even remember what this show is since we did it. What is this? What are we doing?
See, that's not fair. Now you just sound like David Ace Gutierrez. That's not fair at all. Yes.
Now, that wasn't fair. That wasn't fair.
It has been a while since we've done one of these. But, folks, there's an intentional plan here. Because if we just race through the last few Who's Who's, the show's over, guys. There's no more. And we like this show. You guys like this show. So we've kind of got this structure where, you know, we've been keeping the feed alive with, like, Who's That? We did the Wonder Woman 84 flashback special. You know, Siskoid's doing Who's Editing. So the Who's Who spirit is still alive, and we've got plans to keep it rolling. I mean, this is the 16th issue. This is the end of the first iteration of Loose Leaf. You know, after this, we've got the 1993 updates. We've got the Impact stuff. I don't want to hear you people moan. The Impact stuff's good. And we got a plan out on how to cover it. The Mayfair game supplements. We got more Who's That. And we have other surprises, too. So this feed's going to be going for a little bit while, a little while longer. And we're going to have some fun with it. So never mind Rob's snarkiness. You know, instead of saying that, you should have said, this show is so powerful, we launched an omnibus, Rob. That's what you should be saying.
Looking at the pictures everybody's been posting of their omnibi, I feel very sorry for all the hernias that we have delivered to the various members of Amazon or the USPS, because those books are massive. And having had a hernia and
having
had surgery for it just in the last couple of weeks, I can appreciate how painful those are.
Well, Steve Givens messages me that he plans on taking his around to get artists to sign it when convention season starts up. And I'm like, that's going to be fun lugging that thing around for 3 days on the floor. So, yeah, that's a hernia waiting to happen, Steve, right there.
Steve's biceps are going to be huge by the time he gets to, like, the first couple of conventions.
Oh, wow. All right. So, speaking of this, as far as making this thing last, whatever, Rob, this month is 9 years since we started the Who's Who podcast. How insane is that?
I still am charmed at our naivete that in the early days we thought – that we could do coverage of the Who's Who comics as a backup feature in regular episodes of Aquaman and Firestorm.
And what did I tell you about making it its own show?
You probably said whatever. I'm sure that whatever I said, you said, you're right, Rob. That's very smart. That's probably what you said.
Oh, my gosh. No, I insisted we make it its own show. You're like, people aren't going to want to listen to that, as if Aquaman and Firestorm would be more popular than Who's Who. And then I have you on record many times going, Shag was right. You know, people wanted it its own feed. It's our second most popular show on the network. So
this show, like the horizon, the end of the show, like the horizon, will never be met. We will never quite ever get there.
That is the goal. That is absolutely the goal. So, folks, yes, we are here to talk about the final issue of the original run of the Loose Leaf. And if you don't know, because it's been a while, so I've skipped this a couple times, this was a 16-issue miniseries. Retail price was $4.95. That was insane for the price of comic books at that time. And, of course, it's a Loose Leaf format. Normally, you would only get 24 entries per issue. This time, we get 8 extra pages, or really 28 entries, which is pretty exciting. At the same price, they didn't even raise it, bro. I can't believe that. And we'll get into it in just a bit, but I was thrilled. I was a little hesitant to go into this. It's like, oh, it's been a while, but man, I tore through this thing and lived inside these pages, and I'm so excited about talking about it. And you're laughing at me like usual. There we go. All right. So we should take a second to thank our sponsors, what we really should do. This episode of the Who's Who podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, what'd you get, Rob, this time, Rob?
Well, since you're about to pick the most appropriate in-stock trades pick you could possibly do, I just went with a character that does appear in this issue, which is Catwoman. And there's, of course, lots of Catwoman trades to pick from. But I went with Catwoman Volume 1 Copycats, which reprints issues 1 to 6 of the newest Catwoman series by the very talented Joelle Jones. She is the writer and the artist. 208 pages. The normal price is $16.99. In-stock trades price is only $9.85. So that is 42% off. So you can try, if you haven't read this yet, give it a try. Catwoman, Volume 1, Copycats.
So yes, I did get to pick first because I'm the one who collects all the feedback. So I made sure that I got to pick the Who's Who Omnibus, Volume 1, hardcover. If you haven't picked this up yet, folks, it collects the original 26-issue series. It collects the 5-issue Update 87, the 4-issue Update 88, and the 1989 annuals, which I thought we were very clever to cover ourselves, Rob, thinking no one would ever collect those. But, oh, well, they beat us to it. This thing is 1,320 pages. Wow! A cover artist beautifully compiled from all the various – for not all, from several different Who's Who covers, all by George Perez. It looks great. It's full color. Obviously, this thing's a hardcover. And here's the thing, folks. It's normally $150, and that's a lot of money. But, you know, again, 1,320 pages. On In-Stock Trades, you can get it for 42% off right now, so it's only $87. So that's an amazing discount. It's something you love. You should have it in your collection. Rob and I are dancing around it. I'll just come out and admit it, folks. I have not bought this yet. I'm on the fence because the problem is I own the original issues. I've paid for them digitally already. I've spent the last 9 years of my life covering it. And I have it all accessible on the DC Universe app as well. So I'm like, should I pull the trigger? I think my wife would kill me if I would, if I had this in my house. But anyway, it is incredible. If you haven't already bought the individual issues, have it on, pay for it on DC Unlimited and buy it through Comixology, then I highly recommend you pick up the omnibus. And by the way, you're welcome, world. That's Rob and I's 9 years of our lives went into making this omnibus happen. So you're welcome. So please visit InStockTrades.com for all of these and your other trade paperback needs. We also need to thank you folks at home for helping sponsor our Patreon to help keep the Fire and Water Podcast Network on the air, because there's lots of hosting fees and other services and just things in general that take time and money and effort to keep the network afloat, and we couldn't do it without you guys. So we sincerely appreciate your help. And if you'd like to help support the network, please visit our Patreon. What's that URL, Rob?
Patreon.com/FW Podcast.
And while you're there, at certain sponsorship tiers, you get recognized on your favorite Fire and Water shows, just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the Who's Who podcast. Chris Lydon, Damian Wider, David A. Gutierrez, Nathan Archer, Gore Tolton, Steve Givens, Jeremiah Jones Goldstein,
Chuck Coletta, Corey Drew, Michael Atchison, Michael O'Brien, Noah Tarnow, Paul Kinn, Tom Perrin, and Tom Panarese.
Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcast. Now, get out on the social media, folks. We want to hear your thoughts on issue 16. And, you know, you can even look back at the 16 issues in general if you want to talk about this iteration of Who's Who. Again, there's more to come, but if you want to talk about this version, you're welcome to use our hashtag #FWPodcast. Tag us, Fire and Water Podcast, on Facebook or Twitter. And we will have an image gallery for some of these images. We always used to not worry about that because we're like, well, DC's never going to reprint this. Well, now they just might. And in a minute here, we're going to get into these entries, but we need to talk about the cover first. This is issue 16, and it says across the top, final going out with a bang issue. And then it says 8 extra free pages, absolutely free, included, and this is just for Rob, corrected entries for Desaad, Laurel Gand, and Maxwell Lord, because you know the wrong color borders were irritating the hell out of Rob. I mean, because the borders are his favorite thing.
There's something so funny about, like, just how insular comic books can be, or superhero comics, I should say, can be, that, like, they put this blurb on the cover, like, it's exciting, corrected entries. to a small subset of people, that is exciting. But I think to the general populace, they'd be like, what? Like, right. Like, what is, like, why is that exciting? What's a Desaad? And yet, you know, to certain people, it's like, ooh, I can finally put the correct Desaad in my binder. It's so exciting.
I don't need another Laurel Gann. Give me some more Omega Men, please. So the way this works is it's 8 pages, because I'm assuming this works like a normal printing process where you have to have everything in a signature. And signatures can be 8-inch pages or 16 pages. And so they had to do one of those increments. So 8 pages gets you these 3 corrected ones plus one more. And the way they did it, I guess, would be the last entry in the book, which is absolutely brilliant, which we will get to. It's the perfect way to end this thing. So, again, they didn't raise the price, which is pretty awesome. Now, this issue is cover dated February 1992, but it was on sale January 2nd, 1992. What a way to start the year, right there. So on the inside, you get a very, very long editorial piece from Michael Urie, sort of, you know, like a victory lap, if you will. Him talking about what the process of doing this. You get a pronunciation guide, which is cool. It's a nice callback to the old style one. And they mentioned that Diamond Comics, who was the premier comic book distribution company back then, them in Capital City, Diamond Comics awarded this publication the Gem Award for 1990 for Best Innovation of the Year, which is pretty cool because this loose leaf format was pretty amazing. Yes, for you Marvel fans, the Marvel Ohatmu did try to do a loose leaf edition. It was vastly inferior. I'm sorry, people. And this was just really a cool, cool product and good for them. I'm glad they got recognized.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a printing innovation, no doubt about it. So that's cool. They got some shout out for that.
Yep. All right, let's get into the first entry. We're going to start off with this fairly obscure character. not sure many of you have heard of him. He's called Batman. I don't know. It's a weird name. Named after a bat, I guess. Anyway, it is drawn by Norm freaking Breyfogle. It's Batman standing upon some gargoyles amongst the Gotham night sky. He's got the Batarang lifted up in the air, and he's got the bat signal flyer, you know, or the bat signal's up in the sky because he's being called. I have a lot of thoughts on this, but I want to hear your thoughts, Mr. Artist Man, first.
Thank you. I think it's really good. I mean, look, we all love Norm Breyfogle. I mean, I don't know anybody that doesn't like his work, especially when it was on Batman. I have some small nitpicks with this. I maybe wish there was a little more movement as opposed to just a pose, just sort of standing there. I mean, his thigh muscles are really out of control. but overall, I think it's pretty cool. I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty kind of like a savagey picture of Batman. Like the inking style is a little sketchy. There's some like stipple effect, which I like, kind of on the right above the gargoyle there on the right-hand side of the page. I know I don't want to keep – God, I've been doing this for 16-ish episodes now, I guess, which is, you know, forever. But, like, I do feel like an entry like this shows to me the inherent limitations of this format is that every character gets one page. And so everybody's sort of equally the same. And, of course, Batman has so much history, and yet, you know, he gets the same amount of pages, you know, Tigor from the Omega Men. At least the other Who's Who format could, at a glance, suggest, hey, this character is really important because they get two pages or even three. But that, you know, that quibble aside, I'm over. It's a very nice piece.
Okay, I'm a bit on the different side of this.
Your Batman phase is over.
That is true. But this was my Batman phase right here, Rob. 1992. I was all in from like 89 to I don't know late 90s. I was all in on Batman, and Norm Breyfogle is my Batman artist. Like Jim Aparo is your Batman artist, Norm Breyfogle's mine. However, there's been this depressing sort of trend throughout Who's Who. Norm Breyfogle's pieces, other than maybe the Batmobile, they haven't been up to what we expect from him. Like, I don't want to say they're disappointing, but we expect a certain amount from Norm freaking Breyfogle, and they weren't up to par. Like here, a quick glance, everything you just said looks great. But then I started digging deeper. I started scratching at it. And I'm like, his chest is shaped really weirdly. You mentioned his legs, the weird proportions there. The lines are super, super scratchy. Like, I think he actually needed an inker to finish this one for him.
Well,
I got more. The cape. What's the hell's going on with the cape? Like, it covers a little bit of one arm, and then it's huge on the other side. It's like not proportionate on both sides.
Yeah, it kind of disappears, which is weird. Yeah.
And then the gargoyles, you've got like what looks like maybe a Roman gargoyle with the eagle. You've got like a Greek gargoyle with the face, the ram face. And then you've got like a Chinese gargoyle with the dragon head all together in one place. And why does the eagle have a chain in its mouth? Like what?
Because it's insane Gotham City architecture. Come on.
I guess I could buy that. Yeah. Again, on the surface, it looks good. Once I start digging too deeply, I'm not thrilled. But I love Norm Breyfogle. And dude, the inset pictures are so boss. Like the little clash picture on the back of Batman looks amazing. I love the no neck Batman. You know, the shot, of course, in Crime Alley is touching. The one where he's knocking out the bad guy and flipping him over Robin, and then Bruce Wayne's doing his tie. I mean, that's what I want to see. That's Norm Breyfogle right there. The cover, not so much for me.
Okay. I thought it was interesting that in group affiliation, it does not mention the Outsiders.
I know.
Which
isn't
is
that
a
crazy?
Shot at Tim Price from out of nowhere. I mean, it's kind of, and also, and we'll see that one of the things that did kind of bug me about this iteration of Who's Who is they were so inconsistent with the historical appearances or the not. Mm-hmm. And here they do not, they just mentioned Detective 27.
Right.
As opposed to saying, well, this Batman is from kind of Detective 320, which that doesn't, we all know that that doesn't make any sense, but maybe they just, maybe it's even a legal thing. They might have just said, hey, look, like, we, it all has to come from one source, Detective 27. But it just seems weird that in subsequent listings in this very issue, they'll break it down into multiple versions of the character. But here it's like, no, this is all just one big Batman.
I thought that was very strange. Under relatives, you know, his brother's not there, but Uncle Philip is. I have no idea who the hell that is. I guess he was in one of the origins and I just didn't memorize that part. I don't know. Well, first off, let's just start right at the top. There's an error right at the top. It's just created by Bob Kane. That's a mistake. Wow. And then taking a shot there. Then, in the entry, it's interesting. It talks about how year two was his last solo, case. Because that year three had just happened a little while ago where they introduced Nightwing, or should say Dick Grayson. I like how they openly admit that Bruce Wayne is the disguise and that Batman is who he really is. And I think that makes for an interesting contrast. I guess that's the majority of what I got here. Again, I love the inset pictures. I think they look gorgeous. Right now, at this point in time, Batman was on – they were doing the Return of the Scarface storyline. When Brayfogle was drawing it, Alan Grant stuff, Batman versus Predator was on the shelves at this point. Can you believe it? The border, by the way, is red for Hero. And the text is written by Mark Waid. And, if you want more on Batman, you know, on our own network, we've got Batman Nightcast, which covers all kinds of eras of Batman. You know, Michael Bailey and Andy Leyland do the Overlooked Dark Knight. You may not have noticed, but you could probably find Batman on like TV and movies and video games and Legos and like breakfast cereal and some other places too, probably.
Every single piece of media available to you has Batman involved in it in some way.
That is probably true. All right. Talking about taking a shot at Tim Price, let's talk about Black Lightning. So you've got Black Lightning in I want to say it's a short-lived costume. I don't know. I don't really remember this costume. Must have been some era of Outsiders.
I hate this costume so much. So much.
I don't hate the costume. I kind of digging on it, but nothing's ever going to beat that original costume.
No.
That original costume was amazing.
Yeah, which we see on one of the insets.
Yeah. Well, the new costume, it's got lots of dark blue, and then it's got like a lighter blue in the chest area, but the chest comes down to a lightning bolt. Now, here's something that's always interesting, and it varies by artist. The lightning popping off his fingers there, it's not really lightning, it's just sparkly lights, but whatever, is yellow. Whereas a lot of times, Black Lightning's lightning bolts are actually colored black. So that's kind of an inconsistent thing I've always thought was interesting. Here, he's blasting open or punching open, I don't know, knocking open, or spider webbing based on his fingers, a door. And he's obviously supposed to be coming at you. The art, I should have said, by the way, is by Mark Bright and Joe Rubenstein. My biggest thing with this is not so much the costume, because that's probably not Mark's fault. It would have came forever. Mark Bright has a thing with foreheads.
Yeah, he's got a little Hector Hammond thing going on here.
Yeah. I was going to say, the man is born to draw Green Lantern stuff because he could do Sinestro or Hector Hammond, but it doesn't work with these other characters. I mean, even like the inset picture in the bottom right where he's in the school, it's like, man, that forehead goes for miles. So a little troublesome. So, you get the creator by credit, Tony Isabella and Trevor Von Eden. And the background is, you know, it's a great piece. It's written really well, actually. They talk about, the tragic family history he's had growing up in Metropolis and Suicide Slum. Eventually he goes on to compete in the Olympics and wins the gold medal for the decathlon, goes on to become a college professor. He returns to Suicide Slum and, becomes a high school teacher. And the area is just riddled with drugs and organized crime. And he wants to make a difference. So he works with Gambi. I love that name. Gambi the Tailor, who is his brother. I don't know if you knew this. Gambi's brother is Paul. Paul is the tailor to the Central City Rogues that fight the Flash, which is – I love that connection. And originally – and this, the whole reason this is important because originally Black Lightning's powers came from the costume. He had this belt. And so that was actually a thing. So anyway, at some point during one of his adventures, a young girl died due to his powers. And I don't really know if that was off screen or that happened in a comic. Tim, please let me know in the comments there. I don't really know. But he retired, and that's what led to him joining the Outsiders. Because in those first couple issues of Outsiders, he doesn't want to use his powers because of what happened with that girl. Eventually, when the Outsiders disband, because they always disband, he goes back to Gotham City, and that's where we are at this point. He's working with teens, and he's rarely Black Lightning at this point, where the Who's Who entry is. Now, this is an interesting thing I just wanted to add. I liked in the year 2000, once Lex Luthor became president, Jefferson Pierce actually ends up becoming the Secretary of Education, which was pretty cool. I liked the way they used that. Now, Black Lightning, of course, is famously known for being DC's first black superhero with his own series. That was a major, major thing. You know, Tony Isabella was writing it and helped create the character. He had been working on Luke Cage. And I didn't realize this until I was doing a little bit of research. Originally, Black Lightning, there's some controversy around this. He, you know, he's a very well-educated guy, but he would put on a fake accent. He would put on like a fake, as their words, Harlem Jive accent, very exaggerated. And he would wear a fake Afro wig to hide his disguise. So this it's actually a little bit like what Jerry Conway tried to do with Vibe. But that became very controversial. And then later on, you know, added to the mythos, he's got two daughters, Thunder and Lightning, which is really, really cool. Now, I have a question for you, Rob. Well, first of all, Black Lightning is very, very popular. He's got his own TV show right now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So who would you say is the most high-profile black character that DC has? I can think of three, and my brain's bouncing back and forth between all of them.
I mean, you'd have to say Black Lightning simply because he's got a TV series. But, I mean, geez, I would I mean, I can't think of three. I can think of Bumblebee. Which
what?
Is,
I mean, yeah, yes, yes.
She's
yes.
part of the DC Hero Girls series.
That's true. That's
a
that's
huge
true.
Thing.
Billion-dollar industry.
Yeah. I don't know. Is there a third that I'm not thinking of?
Jon Stewart, who was Green Lantern in the cartoons and on all the merchandising for years.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
And Cyborg, movie star. Cyborg.
Oh, of course, Cyborg.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then you could throw Vixen in there, too. But really, her only breakthrough is really Legends Tomorrow.
I can't. Yes. I mean, God, I watched all 4 hours of that movie. So I'm going to forget Cyborg.
So who would you say is the most high profile? Would you stick
Cyborg.
With your Black Cyborg more so than Black Lightning?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think everyone knows that character at this point, thanks to the movies.
Yeah, you're probably right. I don't know the right answer. I struggle with this. For a long time, I would say it was Jon Stewart because, you know, he was Green Lantern for a long, long time. And then they had to go Ryan Reynolds and confuse the whole issue. So I don't know. So I'm just thrilled Black Lightning has his own series. I think it's great. So, all right. Other details here. I'm sorry, you were going to say something?
Well, I have two. Well, okay. I have a story about Black Lightning that I'll mention at the end before we move on.
It's about Saturday Night Live.
It's not really related to the Who's Who listing exactly, but it's, I don't know what other time I would tell it. But anyway, the one thing I want to mention is it gets into his stuff with his work with the Outsiders, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Greenberger, who wrote the listing, really goes out of his way to never mention Batman except for one moment where he says Batman recruited his aide to help an international problem. Black Lightning was reborn and he joined the Outsiders. If you didn't know, you wouldn't know that Batman was part of the Outsiders. And it's like, were they trying to like retcon him out? Because here's the previous listing where they don't mention him as being a member.
Hmm.
And here they're talking about the Outsiders disbanded. They relocated to Los Angeles. And at no point does it mention Batman. And
Batman's trying to separate himself from it.
Right. I mean, but was DC trying to do that? Was DC was that a continuity thing? As far as I know, that didn't get retconned. I mean, now it has to, it's all been retconned out because everything's all different. But I don't know. It just seems weird that they're so trying to separate him from the Outsiders, which was, you know, not only was it a long running book, it was so popular. It had two series at one point.
Well, there was also a pitch because I remember several issues ago, we would stumble across an occasional Outsider character who just really seemed like, wow, this sounds like a pitch for a new thing. And they were working on an Outsider series around this time. And so I don't know why you would want to distance. I mean, even if you're going to put Batman in it, I think you'd still want to have that cachet of saying, Outsiders, there's a Batman connection, everyone. You know,
yeah.
You all love the movies.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't noticed that. And then now you're going to tell a story about Sinbad on Saturday Night Live, I hope, right?
No.
Oh, that's so funny.
No, this is related to Black. Again, I don't know what other time I would ever tell this story. So, all right, very brief. Back when we were all still working in an office, and I was working at CBS Television, which is where I work, one of the big bosses, they distributed, CBS had posters of all of our shows lining the walls. And, of course, CBS owns the CW, or co-owns the CW. I don't know exactly how it works. But anyway, basically one of our shows is Black Lightning. And one of the big bosses, who I liked very much, a wonderful woman named Erica, had a Black Lightning poster up on her wall. And you know, you could pick whatever shows you want. And I thought, well, maybe she just picked a couple at random. And then at some point, she mentioned to me how much she liked the show and liked the character. And I just offhandedly told her, because I just thought she'd find it interesting, I said, oh, well, you know, I'm friends with the guy that created Black Lightning, Tony Isabella, who I am friends with. And she just thought that was amazing. And for people who don't live in the comic book world, like, they can't imagine, like, who it is that, like, creates these characters. You know, it's like it's just a completely mm-hmm. separate thing. And I'm like, oh, and she just thought that was really cool. And like, wow, you really know the guy? I said, yeah, I've known him for a long time. Blah, 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 blah. Fine. So then I got this idea, and I wrote to Tony, and I said, hey, Tony, if I get a copy of Black Lightning number one and I send it to you, will you sign it to Erica so I can give it to her? And Tony, being the great guy that he is, said, absolutely. So I bought a copy of Black Lightning number one, sent it to Tony. He autographed it to Erica, you know, something, something, Tony Isabella. I brought it in and gave it to her, and she started to cry. She was so happy. She couldn't, she just could not, like, again, the people who don't live in the world of comic books, to where, you know, all of us that are listening to this, if you haven't gone to a convention, you're at least familiar with them. And we have a more intimate relationship with the people that make these comics because of conventions, as opposed to like other facets of entertainment where you don't have that as much. So she just couldn't wrap her head around the idea that like the guy that created Black Lightning was A, kind of still around, and that B, like, she was one degree away from him.
He knew she existed.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, right. And then on top of it, he said, so she went and gave it to her. And so she still has the comic to this day. And I'm very proud of that. I'm very proud that I could make that connection to her with Black Lightning. So she now owns the first issue of Black Lightning, number one, signed by the creator of the character.
That's an amazing story. Wow. And it makes me feel bad for like half the mean things I said about you today.
You should. You should always feel bad about that.
You're a nice guy, Rob Kelly.
I'd like to think so. By the way, I will plug, if you like that story, Erica will be appearing on a future episode of the Film and Water podcast, so you can listen, look out for that when it comes out.
Awesome. That's fantastic. Yeah. All right, well, looking at this, we've already talked about the writer and all that business of this entry, but the first appearance was Black Lightning, number one from April 1977, signed by to Erica. And at this point, when this Who's Who came out, The Outsiders had ended about 4 years before this. And really, his last appearance, he may have been like crossovers and whatnot, but the last time he really headlined anything was an issue of Secret Origins. So, and again, this entry is written really, really well. I was very impressed with what they did. So if you want more on Black Lightning, you could check out The Outcasters, which is a podcast by our good friend Tim Price and Ashford, and that's over on the Right On Network. Or you could, of course, watch the television show, for goodness sakes. So, all right, up next, another very obscure character that they just, you know, they didn't get around to, so they waited to just bury it in the 16th issue. Someone named Catwoman, I don't know, again, named after an animal, very strange. And this one's done by Todd McFarlane. They've been promising it for, gosh, like several months now. Todd McFarlane's Catwoman. I think this thing's amazing. I didn't realize Todd was going to make her in that kind of a sexy pose. No, okay, folks, I'm just kidding. I'm rubbing winding Rob up, because Rob's the biggest Todd McFarlane fan on the planet. Yes, for several issues, they promised that Todd McFarlane would do this. And Michael Urie did point out that, no, sorry, Todd was busy. They just had a baby, so he missed the deadline. So instead, they got Brian Stelfreeze, and boy, am I glad they did. This Brian Stelfreeze piece is freaking gorgeous. And it's interesting, you know, usually Stelfreeze would get like Carl Story or someone to ink him, but he inked this one himself. It's Catwoman. She is obviously in Bruce Wayne's office. She's leaning across this really super fancy desk. And she's got a picture frame that's been pulled away from the wall, and there's a safe behind it. She's about to pick the safe, and she's got flashlights in the room, which are creating some really interesting lighting. And you can see reflected in several surfaces that the door to the office has opened, and Batman is standing in the door. But you don't see him, which is what's done so cool. There's actually four shadows in this thing that I want to point out. On the very front of the desk, along by her foot, you can see just a big long shadow of Batman's head and his horns, or whatever you call it, ears. Then on the corner of the desk, the front corner of the desk, the rounded column, you can actually see the silhouette of the door and Batman standing there in the door. You can see that same silhouette up in the top left-hand corner on a vase, the same silhouette of the door in the Batman. And then finally, you see Catwoman's shadow on the painting, on the back of the painting. It just looks great because you've got the two light sources, which, again, is her flashlight, which is right by the safe, and then the door. I can't end any ornate desk. I mean, Stealth Freeze knocked this out of the frickin' park.
Okay.
Oh, you don't like it?
No, wow. I didn't say that. I didn't say that. No, I like it. I don't love it the way you do, obviously. I don't get the whole buildup for McFarlane. I mean, I know that Todd McFarlane was Todd McFarlane, but like, why Catwoman? Like, I don't get what the connection is. Is there a connection to those?
Sexy. I mean, he used to draw Mary Jane ridiculously. Like, she'd be walking around the house in the sexiest, you know, Fredericks of Hollywood lingerie for no apparent reason and stuff like that.
Is that what it is, though? I mean, I just never understood he doesn't have any connection to this character. So it was it was like a cheesecake thing.
Yeah, it was going to be you had to assume it was going to be cheesecake, yeah.
Okay, all right. No, I think this is a good piece. I really like the coloring by Tony Tolan.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the lighting on her back, the blue light, is – it's, you know, in sort of – in the reality of the piece, it's coming off of the computer screen. Mm-hmm. But it really looks like it's coming off her logo, which is a nice touch.
Clever.
So I dig that. I actually, more than even this piece, I actually like the inset, her driver's license photo, more. I really like the way that – the simplicity of that. I really like that little headshot of her.
Okay.
But that was really cool. It's a very nice piece. It's a very nice piece.
Obviously, I'm a little more over the moon than you are. I like Stealth Freeze. I'm a sucker for Stealth Freeze. So I just think this looks great. And more importantly, we're still a year away from Jim Blanton, our Ballant, I guess, giving her like Power Girl sized chest.
Ugh.
So here she looks like a real human being. And I love that. Now, I guess her legs go on for miles. Maybe she doesn't look like completely like a real human being, but it's not as cheesecake as it's going to be in about a year from now.
No, it would get really out of hand very quickly.
Oh, yeah. So the entry here pretty much focuses on Batman Year One and then the miniseries. So this is all focused on her being a prostitute and the things she traveled and worked through with that. Talks about how she trained to fight by Ted Grant, and of course Wildcat, when she was 17 years old, which is a little creepy in hindsight because Geoff Johns and Beau Smith later on was sort of like hook up Ted Grant and Selena, like as in hookup. So that he trained her when she was 17. That's a little, that didn't age well. Anyway. I kind of like this origin, you know, at least the way it's laid out here, the way she fought through adversity and now she's mentoring other wayward girls. I really like that. I think that it's the way Mark Waid has written this piece. It tells a nice story. I've never read the Catwoman miniseries. I don't know. I know J.J. Birch drew it, so I know the art's ripped off of everyone else. But I don't know if I would enjoy that miniseries, but I like the way this piece is written.
I will have to take one quibble with that,
mm-hmm.
is that it opens with, of all the women the Batman has encountered over his long career, Selina Kyle, the Catwoman, is without a doubt the deadliest and most formidable. Maybe? I don't know. Worse than Poison Ivy or Talia? I don't know.
She's the most important. Let's put it that way.
Most important, absolute. Well, I mean, he knocked up Talia, for Pete's sake. I don't know. I think... I don't know. I'm a little dodgy on that, but okay.
In the spirit of Sean Ross, I'm going to hit you with your second. Actually, I forgot to tell you that earlier question about black superhero. That was a secret question. Here's another secret question I've been preparing for you, Rob, because we are going to talk about Talia in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
With Batman, who is his one true pairing? Who is the woman for him? Is it Catwoman? Is it Talia? Or is it just somebody else?
It's absolutely not Talia. I don't know if
really?
It's Catwoman. Yes, it's absolutely not Talia. She's partly in league with a guy that wants to destroy the planet. this is like a bigger subject than we have time for, because we got another 75 entries to get to. I think that I know people loved the idea that these two were together. I mean, they almost got them married not that long ago, but I don't know. I feel like Batman. I don't know. I feel like Batman should not. You know what? We'll talk about this another time. This is too big of a subject.
I will just say,
I definitely go with Catwoman over Talia in terms of a better pairing for Batman romantically.
For me, I think Batman needs a regular person who's not in the superhero game. Sort of like a Lois.
I was kind of going to say that, yeah.
Like Lois Lane for Superman. You know, I think that's when Bruce Wayne does better, is when he's got someone to ground him. That's just me.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yep.
I think it's too self-destructive with Catwoman and Talia.
Yes, absolutely. So.
Now I know they wrote some great stories, like you said, when they almost got married. A lot of people got very invested in that storyline. So you know, maybe it's written well, but in the long run, I think it's not for them.
She's in Dick Tracy terms, she's Breathless Mahoney, and Batman needs his Tess Trueheart. He needs somebody on the straight and narrow.
I like that. That was a nice analogy. I wasn't laughing at you, I was laughing with you. So
thank you.
First appearance listed here is Batman number one, spring 1940. They don't do modern day appearance.
Nope.
Again, a little strange. The border is black for villain. You know, in a couple of years, that's going to get a little sketchy.
She's not really. Yeah.
They need a border for protagonist maybe or something rather than good guy or bad guy, somewhere in the middle. So anti-hero. Ooh, that's probably what it would be. Anyway, at this point, the Catwoman miniseries had been written about 3 years prior to this. So it'd been a while, and we're about 1 year away again from Jim Ballant, you know, inflating the character. And then after that point, once Jim Ballant gets a hold of her, and I realize there's writers and stuff too there. I don't mean to dismiss that. But after that, pretty much Catwoman has an ongoing series almost consistently from that point on.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like the last era where she doesn't. So if you want more on Catwoman, I've already named all the Batman places. They all, you know, apply here as well. So, all right. By the way, it also says created by Bob Kane. sure she was. All right. Up next is Circe, as in Circe from Greek mythology. And this is drawn by Cynthia Martin. It's interesting. You know, the piece is fine. It's Circe sitting, you know, on these luxurious chaise lounge. She's got lots of pillows, and it's supposed to be sexy and, you know, very deep plunging gown with very well separated breasts. And there's dragons and robe that just goes forever, that if she tried to walk, she would trip over, and a crystal orb with Wonder Woman. It's fine. I have nothing against it. But for me, Cynthia Martin was always at her best doing those Star Wars issues. She drew some really crazy style with Star Wars. Whenever she tries to draw like Perez or someone else, it's just like, yeah, I mean, it's fine. I think the dragons are probably the best part of the piece personally. What do you think of it?
I have nothing to say about this piece. I like Cynthia Martin. I agree. I loved her on Star Wars. My only really thing I have to say about Circe, the character, is when I compiled the Wonder Woman Who's Who clip show, I forgot the Circe listing, and everyone called me out on it. And I apologize, because it was just I pulled a boner, everybody.
Or Rob was planning ahead because he knew we were going to cover Circe next. So maybe that's
what it was. Yeah, that's it. Sure.
And I was sure you were going to complain about her her logo just being a font, but all right.
It's okay. It's fine. The piece is nice. Again, I like Cynthia Martin, but yeah, the font is not good. It's hard to read. It's just a typeface. Especially, you've got all that dead space up top. Like, you're really going to be there. Would have been easier to read.
Well, it's probably what Cynthia Martin was thinking they would do when she drew it, I'm sure. Yep. So the entry itself, it gets into lots and lots and lots of Greek mythology people that I'm not going to cover here. The short version is Wonder Woman gets mixed up with Circe of mythology. She is nearly devolved back into clay. But Julia Capitellis, who was Wonder Woman's friend, or Diana's friend at the time, she interceded. Ultimately, Diana won. Then Circe had just recently returned to orchestrate the War of the Gods, which, by the way, had only ended 2 months prior to this. So Circe was still kind of a big deal at this point. Now, Circe gets historical at first appearance.
Right, yeah.
and then modern-day appearance. Really? Okay, sure. I guess that makes sense. Whatever. Not a lot more really to go on here. The entry is written by Robert Greenberger. The border's black for villain. And, you know, again, if you want more on Wonder Woman, you know, there's the Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace podcast is out there. You know, Davil Franks got his Diana Prince and the new Wonder Woman blog, which has nothing to do with this era of Wonder Woman. But, hey, it's more Wonder Woman. That's always a good thing. So it's an interesting character. They've done a lot with her, but it's not really my bag.
Let's move on.
Yep, we're moving on to Commissioner Gordon. Drawn by Jim Fern. This is a fantastic two-thirds of a drawing. Commissioner Gordon looks great. He's sitting at his desk. He's got a coffee cup. He's got his name tag or whatever, or the desk thing. He's got a pencil. His mustache just looks sexy enough. I could go swimming in it. I love it. He's got those big glasses. He just looks rugged. And then there's that, what the hell is that looking Batman behind him?
Can I say I wish that Batman was not in this piece at all?
Yeah, I agree. You can say that. And I would completely back you on that. Yeah. Not just because it looks messed up, but this is about Commissioner Gordon.
Yeah, exactly. So he doesn't need to be, and we all know who he is, so he doesn't
exactly
need, Batman doesn't need to show up. Yeah, I wish they had just given him his own listing.
Yeah. Speaking of things I didn't need the inset picture from Killing Joke.
I was going to say the same thing. I really hate that that's one of the – there's only two pictures. He actually has more history than Batman. more history. But, yeah, I hate that of the two insets, one of them is from Killing Joke. I just, yeah,
you like, get him in the gimp costume being tortured with pictures of his daughter. And then you get him with Sarah Essen. But it is a nice recap of year one, the way it's written. It's done well. It talks about, you know, he was in Chicago. He comes to Gotham, all the corruption. Talks about him being on a task force to capture the Batman. Explains how Gordon comes to trust Batman. It addresses, you know, the family, James Jr., his wife, Barbara, who a lot of people seem to have forgotten about, his niece, Barbara, and then Sarah Essen and how she had come back into his life at this point, which is really interesting. And the first appearance of Detective Comics number 27. I don't know that I knew that. I don't know that I knew he was writing that first issue.
He's there from the beginning.
Written by Peter Sanderson, and the border is blue for supporting cast. And if you want more about Commissioner Gordon, of course, there's a television show called Gotham, which is all about him. There's movies, TV shows, games, all that kind of stuff. He doesn't have his own breakfast cereal, which I think is disappointing.
But just wait. Anyway. Just wait long enough.
That's probably true. All right. Next up is Cosmic Odyssey by Walt freaking Simonson. Oh, my gosh. This thing is whether you like the series or the miniseries or not, it's a work of beauty. It's got the Cosmic Odyssey logo, which was from the comic. You've got the anti-life sentient creature in the background, and the surrounding are all these heroes. You got Superman, Forager, Martian Manhunter, Orion, Light Ray, John Stewart, Highfather, Starfire, Darkseid, Batman, the Demon Etrigan, and an awesome Dr. Fate. They're all kind of just standing around, so it looks a bit like a Who's Who cover, but I love it because, you know, it's Walt Simonson, so it looks great.
Is this the second and only other drawing of Dr. Fate by Walt Simonson? Other than, of course, the beloved first issue special, which we've...
Coming soon to the Firewater Podcast.
Yeah.
I'd have to think on that. I
can't think of another time where he's drawn Dr. Fate.
Probably on a cover or something somewhere.
Maybe. I don't know. It's pretty rare. Still pretty rare.
Well, the this event category is rare in and of itself. And it's interesting they got Simonson to draw this because Mignola drew the series. So I'm not sure how Simonson got tapped for this. I'm glad he did.
I think Mike was on the Hellboy train at this point.
92? I don't know if he was. I don't know. Maybe. So basically the story here is Metron's is, you know, as always, searching for the anti-life equation. And in this case, the anti-life equation is taken on sentience. And so Darkseid and Highfather actually form a truce to save the universe. And they gather together all those heroes I rattled off. So that's kind of the premise of the story. Sadly, though, Cosmic Odyssey is mostly known for the destruction of a planet called Zanish or Zanshi. I can never say the stupid thing. Anyway, and the destruction was due to the overconfidence of John Stewart, Green Lantern, unfortunately. And this is a very emotional story beat that hung over John Stewart for more than a decade. It even inspired a Justice League animated series episode, which I just beat Chris Franklin to writing in the comments. No, interesting, when they do these event categories, which are gray, there's no first appearance. They don't give you any indication of when it happened. A year would be nice. Anyway, but this one's written by Robert Greenberger. And at this point, Cosmic Odyssey was 3 years ago. But in a rare decision, DC was only 6 months away from publishing a trade paperback of Cosmic Odyssey. And trade paperbacks were not a common thing in 1992, folks.
Can I say this is one of my – I don't know if it's my single favorite, but it is one of my favorite innovations of this iteration of Who's Who, that they did events. Mm. Superhero comics are – especially at this point, we're so in love with events that it became a coin of the realm. And I think it makes a lot of sense. If you're trying to tell the history of your comic book universe, you have to make room for events.
Yeah.
So I really liked that they did this. I wish they had done this at Who. Well, by the time the original Who's Who, they really weren't doing events for the most part. So I can see why they wouldn't have gotten around to it. But I do like that they made room for that. I think it makes a lot of sense.
Well, they still could have done some of that. I mean, there were some big turning points, you know, the destruction of Kryptonite or the death of Batman's parents. Or, I mean, there were still watershed moments in the DC Universe history they could have talked about, you know.
Well, I mean, those are specific to a character. I just mean these sort of you know, crossover, multiple issue. I mean, you know, Who's Who was pre-crisis. So, I mean, they didn't really start doing it. But I just think it makes a lot of sense. If you're going to do them every year and you're going to brand them and you're going to give them their own logo and you're going to be like, hey, buy all 76 parts, right, it makes sense to then give it a list.
Yeah. And can I say that I hope Rob starts every question for the rest of the show with "Can I say?" Because I think we're on like the fourth or fifth one now. So I think that would be – I think we should keep that train rolling.
Okay.
If you want more on Cosmic Odyssey, you can check out DC OCD. They covered that when they went through all the different various events. So now they're into the New 52, so I stopped listening. Actually, that's not true. I'm just kidding, Paul. Anyway, all right. Next up is the Demon supporting cast. This is first of all, I should say, by the way, the art is by Val Semeckis and Carl Kessel, and it looks great. It's beautifully rendered, but it's a little bit like the Hell's Hierarchy entry a few issues ago. It's cool, and it looks great. It's really only meaningful to Demon fans.
Do we really need this listing? I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, Demon was really trying to create a little corner of the DC universe in and of itself. I never read the series, but it certainly seemed to have some cachet. A lot of people in the comments have said it's not that great. I don't know. Let's just run through it. There's three main characters that are listed here. Randu Singh, I guess is how you say his name. He's a blind mystic with ESP. He's a longtime ally of Jason Blood. Then you've got Harry Matthews. I love his last name, by the way, and it's spelled correctly. Harry Matthews is a living pillow. Yes, I said that right. He is a living pillow. Basically, he was this tough-talking, cigar-chomping advertising executive who got transformed into a freaking pillow made of flesh. He's got it's a pillow with a face and eyes and hair and everything. And he's got a human personality. He just doesn't have a soul anymore. Then we've got Glenda Mark, who is Jason Blood's love interest usually. She has been his companion through many, many mystical adventures. First appearance here is the Demon number one. So I don't know which character appeared first. I'm going to assume it was Glenda, probably. And at this point, it's written by Robert Greenberger, and the border is yellow or blue for supporting cast. And at this point, Demon was on issue number 21. So, and you got some good inset pictures. You got Jason Blood with Glenda back when she had long hair. You've got Glenda slapping an old wizard type person. And then you've got Clarion the Witch Boy, who I can't stand. All right, moving on.
I did nothing on this.
That's fine.
No offense to the Demon. I like the character, but I never read a single issue of this series, and I feel like a supporting cast listing is generous.
I feel bad because, again, there's a lot of creative talent attached to that series, both the early run with Alan Grant and Val Semeckis, and then the later run with, Garth Ennis, or maybe it was Warren Ellis took over, whoever. Anyway, there's a lot of talent attached to that book. I feel like I should read it. Anyway, up next is the entry Rob has been waiting for the entire time. Yes, it is Desaad.
Hope it's corrected.
First off, you've got on the front the logo, which, by the way, I don't even know if it's a logo or a typeface, but Desaad is now white, where it was black before. You couldn't read it before. And on the back, the border is black for villain. So there you go, Rob. You can sleep easier at night. Next.
I know.
All right, next is Devlin O'Ryan, who's a member of the Legion of Superheroes. And you can tell because the Legion of Superheroes logo is right there. And the cover is really cool. So Devlin's sitting there. He's got a typical sort of Keith Giffen gray jacket look from then. But he's wearing this green undershirt with a yellow and red sort of circle star thing, which looks great. Gives kind of just a hint of the classic Legion feeling. He's got red hair. And there's a Dominator standing behind him. And a Dominator has pulled a pistol and is shooting Devlin in the back of the head. However, Devlin's power to create portals has grabbed the laser blast. It has portaled out from behind Devlin's head. It appeared behind – the blast has actually appeared behind the Dominator itself. And so the Dominator is blasting his own head using the cool portal effect. It looks great, doesn't it?
Sure.
Here's the weird thing. That's not Devlin O'Ryan's power. So Jason Pearson, who drew a really nice piece, did not quite understand how Devlin O'Ryan's power works. It is not a portal power. It is just a reflection power that basically should have blasted him and the blast should have bounced right back out. So you don't like this? This doesn't look drab like Keith Giffen's Legion. This is like a nice superhero-y version.
I feel as though if you weren't already completely bought into the Legion of Superheroes, almost all these listings across the 16 issues will not only not convert you, will actively push you away from the Legion of Superheroes.
You know, I haven't said it lately, but I never liked you. So let's get that out there.
He texted it to me earlier today, but I guess you mean on air.
That's an auto text. That just generates every day.
You said that to come out every month.
Yeah. So the creator credit is Tom Bierbaum, which is a little weird because every other time I've only ever seen Tom and Mary Bierbaum together. So I've never seen Tom by himself get credit. So I don't know what that's – maybe they had a bad fight. I don't know, whatever. Anyway, the gist of it is Devlin O'Ryan is a Cub reporter for the Daily Planet of the 30th century. Are you laughing? Is that what you're doing?
Like, what a weird story you've crafted for yourself. Maybe they had a fight. What a dick move that would have been. Like, where did you get that from? That's so funny to me. I'll show you. I'll take you off the credits on who's who.
For Devlin O'Ryan.
That'll show you.
Right.
Oh, boy.
Woo. Okay. I needed that. That's hot in here now. Anyway, so Devlin is Cub reporter again for the Daily Planet. I mean, this is kind of, he's not really so much a superhero as he's more like kind of a Jimmy Olsen. Like, you know, he's part of the adventures and he's a side character, but he's not really a hero, even though technically he joins the Legion with his reflection power. Well, it's true. At one point he's called Reflecto, then he's called Reflex. And I don't even remember him really being a very active member. Again, more like a Jimmy Olsen. He gets wiped out with Zero Hour, which is unfortunate because I did like this guy. He was very charming. He was like the young go-getter. A couple things. The body of the entry is written – like every space is filled because it's Tom and Mary Bierbaum. They won't let a period or a paragraph go without a chance to write it. And so there's a lot of text here. But it does talk a lot about his brothers and sisters. And yet under relatives, there's no mention of brothers or sisters. So I don't know. I do like how they sort of wrap in the Flash, Barry Allen, Iris West stuff in here because Devlin worked for Iris West in the 30th century because, you know, she's from the future at one point towards the end of Barry's series. So that's kind of cool. I like that. And they broke the story together about the Dominion covert takeover of Earth. So that was kind of how he became famous. And I love the little inset drawings. He's like falling asleep between stacks of paperwork, which is great. And then there he's meeting with the young Legionnaires. These are what's called the SW6 batch of Legionnaires. At the time, we didn't know whether they were clones, time displaced, and you can actually multiple choice pick your answer because they resolved in every different kind of way you want because of Zero Hour. But here he's hanging out with the younger version of the Legion, which is – he fit really nicely with that. So it worked well. Your border is red for hero, although at this point I would say should probably be supporting cast. I don't know. Cisco is arguing with me, I'm sure. First appearance is Legion of Superheroes, the fourth series, number 6. So that is the 5 year later series. So I like it. Obviously, Rob hates everything that's fun.
What is that thing on his belt? Is that supposed to be a holster of some sort?
Probably just a futuristic pocket of some sort, you know, just to carry your stuff there.
The size of a milk carton. I mean,
well, he's a reporter, so maybe that's where he keeps his computer or something for submitting stories. I'm just making crap up at this point.
All right. Okay, sure.
Look at the Dominator. He's got 3 pouches. It's the 90s. It's pouches.
Okay. All right.
Pouches. Anyway, for more on Devlin O'Ryan, you can check out the Legion of Super Bloggers, of course. So up next, all right, for the love of God, all right, people, not only is it the Forever People, all right. It is Forever People once again with amazing artwork. What WTF all over this, okay? So far, we've had Jack Kirby. We've had Ty Templeton. And now we've got Art Adams. Would somebody please make these space hippies cool already? Because they keep getting represented amazingly, but it doesn't pay off in the comics.
I can't be sure, but I think there have been more Forever People listings than there have been Who's Who series at this point. I don't know how to do
that. But they all look amazing.
Yeah, the Who's you have to give it to the Forever People in terms of artistic representation, as you just delineated there. That is a murderer's row of artists drawing those characters, and yet I still don't like these characters. I just don't care. I just don't care. But yet, I mean, yeah, what a run of artists. Obviously, they are artist favorites. They're not fan favorites, but they are artist favorites because there's no way you get Art Adams to draw the Forever People unless he loves these characters.
Well, you get to draw Big Bear and you get to draw Beautiful Dreamer. That's got to be fun right there. So in this version of the story, they describe that it's 5 humans from different Earth time periods. And then these 5 characters did they even list the names? Okay, Beautiful Dreamer, Big – I think I just heard Rob yawn. Did you hear that, guys, on the air? Beautiful Dreamer, Big Bear, Mark Moonrider.
Good morning, guys.
Seraphin and Viken, or supposed to be Viking, but it's Viken is kind of how they spell it. Anyway, they come together like Captain Planet and create Infinity Man. And they kind of exchange places with him. Anyway, in this story, they talk about how they battled the dark. They battle side Darkseid's forces. It was a lot of, it's written in that way that I love so much, which is a lot of this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. Yawn. Please don't do that. Anyway, the gist of what you walk away with is they're space hippies, and we're supposed to think they're cool. And they, beautiful dreamer and Big Bear at this point have had a child that kind of hung around in continuity for a while. Also, they, you know, another thing too, Rob, it's not even in the picture. They ride around in a totally badass super cycle. I mean, there's so much going for these guys. Someone needs to do a story that's worth reading. It's just not
fair. You know, based on this, and I've said this, I think about other Art Adams pieces regarding the New Gods. Mm-hmm. You look at this, and if you, I feel like if you brought this to Cartoon Network, I mean, back in the day, it would have been like ABC for Hanna-Barbera. But you look at this and you're like, can we get the Forever People as a cartoon series? You'd be like, yeah, based on this drawing, these guys look right. Yeah, let's do this. And then you turn it into a toy line just so you could get the car, the floating car.
Right.
Boss. Yep.
I mean, they've even got the whole Village People kind of thing going with everyone representing different things and everything. It's written by Peter Sanderson. We already talked about Art Adams. The Border is Red for Hero Team. Now, this is 4 years after their miniseries. And they're still pulling entries and pulling Art Adams. It's crazy. So if you want more on the Forever People, you can look probably Lining Bird Cages. It's probably about the only place you're going to find issues of the Forever People. So there you go.
Oh, now that was –
wow, because that was too far. That was apparently crossing the line.
Still talking about Jack Kirby, for God's sakes.
Well, I'm about to talk about Jerry Ordway, so watch
all
out.
Right. All right.
And you know I love Jerry the Extraordinary Ordway, but this drawing of Infinity Inc. is very disappointing. It's Jerry Ordway and Mike Macklin drawing the later years of the Infinity Inc. group. So you've got Nuklon, you've got Brainwave Jr., you've got Obsidian, who we all know, and Jade. But then you get Mr. Bones, you get the second Wildcat, and you get the second Dr. Midnight. It's not a great piece. I can't think of a piece in Who's Who history that Jerry Ordway did that wasn't phenomenal until now.
It's, you know what, to me, it's fine.
That's probably the right word.
Fine. There's nothing wrong with it. I actually kind of like it. It's Ordway inked by Macklin, which is a great combo, but it's simply fine. And I think part of it is, I mean, we'd have to go back and look at them all, but like all the Ordway pieces, I think for the original Who's Who series used Zipitone in some manner to give them some extra level of depth. But that's not going on here. He didn't do that. And I think that might have just been because that was, I don't think any Zipitone is used at all in this Who's Who series. So that might be part of it. It's a fine drawing, and it's the kind of thing where if anyone else had done it, you'd say it was great. But because it's by Jerry Ordway, one of the best guys ever to do it, anything that's not completely like knocks your socks off, you just go, it's okay. It's a little just slightly underwhelming, even though if a lot of other artists drew it, you'd say, boy, that was one of the best things they ever did.
Yeah, that's probably fair. That's probably fair. I guess I expect so much from him because he's delivered every single time.
And there is one really great part of this list.
Oh, I got an issue with that great part. Let's flip to the back. All right. So this, Rob wants to talk about the inset picture, I assume, right?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, there's the main shot of the group of them all. Nuklon is bowing down as he fits in the picture there. Mm-hmm. And then you get a second inset of Solomon Grundy asking where Jade is. Jade is Gundu's friend.
Mm-hmm.
Got Hour Man looking kind of like, and Power Girl looking. I like that. I like that it tells like a little story that like the Infinity Inc. showed up for their class picture for Uzu, and then like for some reason Solomon Grundy got late and he's upset. I think that's fun.
I like your thought process there, but I don't think that's what's happened here. I think that's a panel from the comic because Our Man was never part of Infinity Inc.
No.
So, well, that's not true. I'm sorry. I take that back. Our Man 2 was.
Yeah, but he never wore that costume.
Right? I don't remember him wearing that costume. No. Maybe he did at some point, but I don't remember. And Power Girl, I'm not even, she may be mentioned in here somewhere, but she's not in any of the other picture. So I think they took this from a panel from the comic because that's what it feels like. Which is disappointing to me if that's what happened. Because it's funny. It's adorable to think they didn't make the class photo. You're right. But it is a little worrying. So overall, the Infinity Inc., you guys know, they're the children of the JSA. They fame their own superhero group. The entry, though, written by Robert Greenberger, is very, very downbeat. I mean, it really is. It makes it sound like, they tried and failed. I mean, it's really the way he writes it, which at this point they kind of had. I mean, the series had been over now for 4 years, and the characters just were pretty much lost. And it honestly, it sort of echoes my feelings on it. Like, every time I've ever tried to read the Infinity Inc. series, like, I love the concept behind it, but the issues themselves, they never engage me. Like, ever. Even the Stream of Ruthlessness issues are just okay. They're not amazing. So I feel like this is kind of representative of my feelings of the group. I know you have a passion for them.
Yeah, I like this team. I always have. Yeah, they're kind of morts in a lot of ways, but I just love the JSA so much. I know you do too. And we'll get to some of these issues over on the JSA Presents thread. It is sort of funny that if they felt the need to strip a panel out of Infinity Inc. and just drop it in, to fill space, they should have gotten the beer bombs to write this listing. They would have filled it up. They would have until the very end. Yeah, I mean, I didn't think about that, but you're right. I bet it is probably lifted from an issue of the comic. But that, again, it doesn't bother me because it's just cute. But yeah, you're right. The whole listing is like, yeah, they worked for a while, but now they're not so much. They're all like, you know, Wildcats are rock turtles. Nuklon continues to study engineering. You know, you're like, oh, well, all right. So why do we care?
Right.
they're again, gone now.
I just want to be clear. I love the characters and I love the idea. It's just the actual comic itself that I struggle with. So, and just to clarify, yes, we will talk about Infinity Inc. some on JSA Presents, but Keith G. Baker, I'm sorry. I don't think we're going to launch your amazingly titled Infinity Inc. and Beyond series. Or to Infinity Inc. and Beyond, I think is what he called it. I don't think we're going to launch that series. I'm sorry. All right, up next, by contrast, is one that I absolutely love, which is Krypton. I love this design. I love the John Byrne era-looking Krypton world and architecture. I think it looks freaking stunning. So you've got the cool Jor-El sort of John Byrne-ish buildings, and then you've got little inset pictures of what the same area looked like over the years. The art is by Dusty Abel and John Beatty. What do you think of the image? I mean, I know it's just a static image of a building, but what do you think of it?
I mean, it's fine. I'm not super. I mean, you know, it's just some geography, and it is taken all from the John Byrne, which of course is denoted here in the first appearance. Here they do the current version. They have historical Action Number One, current version, Man of Steel Number One. I am starting to think it's a legal thing. I really am starting to wonder if there isn't some legal hang up, so they have to do that for Superman or Batman for some reason.
Well, I know the created by is a legal thing. I know that much.
Right, but I wonder, well, anyway, we'll never know. But anyway, it's fine. It's not exciting to me. It's just a kind of drawing of a building and whatever. But it's important. I mean, Krypton is one of the big, you know, settings of the DCU, so it makes total sense.
Roger Stern wrote the entry, and it's really well done. It's almost like mythology. It's really interesting. I've never read the World of Krypton miniseries, so I didn't know any of this stuff. There's 8 different ages in Krypton's history. Some of these ages lasted 100,000 years. They talk about terrorists and thermonuclear devices, you know, wiping out people and cloning, and finally how the race becomes sterile. I mean, it's just really written in an interesting way that makes the history kind of come alive. So I was very impressed with that. Again, Roger Stern did that. Geography is the border, so it's green. First appearances, you already mentioned that, but it does have the creator credit, you know, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, which is great. And for more on them, well, you could obviously watch the Krypton TV show or pretty much any podcast Michael Bailey's on, give you more information. And it's worth mentioning the Superman books at this time were hitting a very well-known, beloved story called Panic in the Sky. So that's where we were with Superman.
Is there a more famous planet in pop culture history? Fake planet?
I was gonna say Earth.
would Vulcan count? Would Vulcan be a little more famous? In terms of the average person would say, do you know what planet Spock is from? They'd know it. Or would you say what planet Superman is from?
Superman. Because kryptonite is in the lexicon of terms people use. And Superman is more well known than Spock worldwide. So
that's fair. Yep.
Yeah. So I'd say Krypton's the most famous fictional planet. You're probably right.
Okay.
So, all right. Up next is, and I've got a pocket full of kryptonite, I should mention, by the way. All right. Up next is the color corrected. is the color corrected entry for Laurel Gand. So not only do you get a color corrected entry, which Rob loves, you also get the fake Supergirl from the 5YL Superman, or Legion era. So Rob's just favorite thing all the way around. Anyway, it's here. We've already talked about the character. We don't need to spend any time on it. Instead, we're going to jump forward to Legion of Superheroes, The Beginning, which is a clever entry. This falls under events as well. And instead of focusing on a miniseries of some sort, what they've done is focused on what the Legion of Superheroes were like when they first started, because now the 5YL era is so different. So this talks all about Cosmic Boy and Saturn Girl and Lightning Lad and how they came together as a team. The front drawing is by Chris Sprouse and Al Gordon, and I absolutely adore it. You've got the three heroes in their in each sort of an iconic pose, you know, getting ready to do something. You've got the logo up there. You've got the background. It looks like they're in a space airport, which makes sense because they met on a flight. I love it. Oh, and I love Chris Sprouse with the Legion. I'm a total sucker for Chris Sprouse and the Legion. What do you think of it?
That's a great drawing. I mean, I'm a fan of Chris Sprouse. So I like that Chris Sprouse knows how to make people look like teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard to do. These three, if you didn't know anything about the Legion, you would know immediately these are teen superheroes because they don't look like – they look like, you know, young adults, but they're not adults. And that's really hard to do. And he gives them all distinctive faces. They all kind of broad noses. They have a slight – similar look, but they're distinctive enough. I like the effect of their powers. I like the little rings coming off of Cosmic Boy. And I like that it gives them a, you know, like a setting. It's sort of funny. There's one guy right in the background behind Saturn Girl's head who's just walking around. Like, he's not paying attention. Boy, whatever's going on here is really not even worth – he's got to go get, like, his duty-free candy bar or something.
Right.
But no, this is it's marvelous drawing.
And I love that, like, Lightning Lad, he's just, his face looks a little bit different, like his eyebrows and his forehead. I mean, he looks like how I kind of envision Cannonball from New Mutants, kind of like, you know, Chris Franklin's territory, Kentucky looking. And Saturn Girl is a little bit sexy, but also a little bit girl next door. You know, it really works the way it's done. Cosmic Boy just got like an awesome sort of, you know, leadership quality looking to him. I love it. I think it's fantastic. And so as you get into the entry, they talk a lot about how they saved R.J. Brand from assassination on this flight. R.J. Brand then becomes the financier who supports the Legion of Superheroes. He pays their way, funds the whole thing. And he's inspired by not Superboy's activities in the 20th century, but now Valor, which is Mon-El, in the 20th century. And that's sort of their inspiration. And then it, you know, talks a lot about – I don't need to get into Legion history. But it does talk about one of the things in this changed timeline is that the evil sorceress Glorith has manipulated time. In this timeline, she actually made sure the Legion of Superheroes were created because she needed someone to oppose Mordru. If there was no one to oppose Mordru, he would have gone unchecked and would have been too powerful. So in order to stop that, she facilitated the creation of the Legion of Superheroes. So sort of interesting. There's a lot of detail on how they did it and the acronym Legion and the Derlin and all. I'm not going to get into it. But anyway, it's a fun entry written by Tom and Mary Beerbaum. So there's a lot of words. And it doesn't.
They obviously didn't have a fight in this one.
Right. There's no first appearance. There's none of that stuff. But you do get the border again of event. And, you know, at this point, Legion of Superheroes was on issue number 27. And as I mentioned earlier, the SW6 batch. And that's another reason, by the way, for this entry, is the SW6 batch had just been introduced. And again, they were supposed to be like echoes of the Legion when they were all very, very young and had just formed the team a little while into it. So this entry pairs nicely with those SW6 kids who were going to get their own series coming up very soon called Legionnaire. So it all ties in together nicely. And of course, check out Legion Super Bloggers for more information. Up next is Major Victory by Jerome K. Moore and Ray McCarthy. Actually, it says Jerome K. Moore with Ray McCarthy, which is kind of weird wording. But anyway, this is your very, very patriotic hero. You know, he's got a red, white, and blue sort of thing going on. The blue and the stars at the top and the white at the bottom, some red stripes, and he's got his foot propped up on some rubble, and he's holding like a battered American flag, and behind him you can see the SR-71 Blackbird spy plane as the X-Men fly away. You see some soldiers, and you're supposed to laugh at that. Washington, D.C. appears to be on fire, so this must be, what, January 6th? So it's a – wow, that was probably too soon, wasn't it? Anyway, I love this piece, man. Like, the patriotism in this piece just is inspiring. I'm a sucker for patriotic heroes anyway. I love this thing. What do you think of the drawing?
The shredded flag makes you feel patriotic. That's interesting.
No, the character. He's lifting the flag back up. Making things right.
All right, I got a couple different things. First of all, Tony Tollin must have been very proud of his coloring work because he signed this piece.
I noticed that. There's a lot.
See the colorist sign the piece. I will say, when I got to this listing, I was like, what? This guy gets his own list? Like, what?
Oh, my
gosh. And then I read it, and I was like, oh, he went on to join the Suicide Squad. So, okay, he had a life outside of the Force of July. So, okay, I understand that now. Just because you wondered aloud with the whole with credit, my hunch is that Mr. McCarthy, again, this is just a guess on my part, but I'm guessing that Mr. McCarthy maybe drew the backgrounds, he did background work, and that's a little different than inking the piece, because I've seen other Jerome K. Moore work, and it looks like this, that he's inked himself. So I'm betting he inked the figures, and then maybe Ray McCarthy came in and did the brickwork. You know, or the stipple effect in the clouds, like more of a background thing. So he gets kind of a lesser credit.
If I thought about it, I'm friends with both of them on Facebook and I've interacted with both of them a lot. Like Ray used to ink Firestorm. We talked to him.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, we dealt with him a couple times, and Jerome, I'm in a couple of different groups with him. I should have asked. But yeah, I regardless of who did what, I think it's a beautiful piece.
It's a great piece. I mean, it's a great – Jerome K. Moore's a great artist, and it's a great piece. The character almost doesn't deserve it. It's such a nice drawing.
Well, it's in a lot of ways, you're so right, because Suicide Squad at this point is 4 months away from cancellation, all right? So obviously you mentioned, yes, 4th of July, and then he ends up mixed in with the Suicide Squad, kind of against his will, really. And by the way, they do give the credit to Mike W. Barr and Jerome Moore for creating the character. And he has no real powers. He's just peak strength and endurance. But even the entry itself, written by Robert Greenberger, reads great. I mean, this could have been DC's Captain America if they'd had the right writer.
Oh, I think you're
– well, okay, maybe not.
That's
maybe,
generous.
Okay. Well, I don't mean necessarily – I'm sorry, that the lead character of the Marvel Universe kind of thing. I just mean the patriotic hero that people get behind. I think with the right writer, with that costume, this look, this writing – this could have gone somewhere after Suicide Squad and been an interesting story. The problem is he was never in a book that was that compelling. And he was never given the chance to, so I feel like the character was kind of squandered. Now, I, in full disclosure, I am a sucker for patriotic stuff in comic books. I love the 4th of July idea. In fact, in my role-playing game, it inspired me – the 4th of July specifically inspired me to create a patriotic theme group called the Revolutionary Warriors. So I adore it completely and utterly. I am a sucker for this thing, man. So first appearance is Batman and the Outsiders Annual number 1 from 1984. I mentioned Sanderson already. He got the border of red for hero because, damn it, he is a hero. And right at this point, again, Suicide Squad on issue 62. It's about to get canned, which is a real shame. So for more on Major Victory, though, you could check out Task Force X podcast by Aaron Head Moss or The Outcasters because they obviously are going to talk about the 4th of July. All right. Up next is Matrix, a.k.a. Supergirl. The drawing, we'll talk about the drawing first. The drawing is by Dusty Abel and John Beatty, and it is Supergirl. She is this version of Supergirl. She's flying in the air. She looks very much like the traditional Supergirl for the most part from pre-crisis. I mean, she's got the pointed sleeves and the red skirt and all that jazz. Superman's in the background. And then amongst the clouds, you sort of see the weird face, which is the protomorph shape of Matrix. So ignoring the protomorph face there, what do you think of the Supergirl and Superman here?
Yeah, it's fine. I really wish that face in the clouds wasn't there.
Right, I know. Yeah. She does have sort of a weird expression on her face. Like she's looking over her shoulder at Superman. She's kind of like, this kind of looks like what I'm seeing. But this was a great look for Supergirl. They really took the classic elements that worked and brought it to a new post-crisis sort of way. And she looked great. Now, as you get into the entry, this is an unfortunate period in the Supergirl era because this is more Matrix than Supergirl. What came right after this is like you got kind of a classic version of Supergirl, and the stuff before it they didn't dwell on. But here what you get a lot of is – all right, okay, this is really overly complicated, folks. All right, there's a pocket universe that they had to create for Legion of Superheroes with Superboy. Once they get rid of Superboy, then you're dealing with Lex Luthor is there. He uses proto-matter and combines it with Lana Lang. Again, it's overly complicated. They create a Supergirl, okay? And she can shape-change, though. That's the deal. You get a Supergirl who can shape-change. Superman comes to this alternate universe. There's a bunch of evil Kryptonians that Superman executes, and that becomes a big thing with Exile. The bottom line, what they really just need to get to, is that this Matrix, or Supergirl, came to our Earth, and she's raised by Ma and Pa Kent. And for a while there, she's like impersonating Clark Kent. Well, he's in exile. That's where you get the picture in the bottom right-hand corner there. That's Rob, that's Superman 3 come to life in comic book form. And then later, Matrix leaves Earth because she has some problems she felt, and she leaves Earth and goes off in space herself. And I mentioned on the shelves right now is Action Comics number 674, which is the beginning of the Panic in the Sky storyline, which honestly was the as far as I'm concerned, and the Superman people can argue with me, but as far as I'm concerned, Panic in the Sky was the beginning of Supergirl becoming a reoccurring character in the Superman books again. This was the beginning of her becoming not putting the Matrix stuff behind her, but just sort of saying, yeah, that happened, but we're just not going to talk about all that much anymore. We're just going to talk about her being Supergirl now. And that's where Supergirl really started to click, is in the Panic in the Sky story. And that's where they are right now. So all of this here, very complicated. But anyway, what's your take on all this?
I don't know this era of Supergirl. I actually want to hear what Ange thinks. So wait for the comments of this episode, and then Ange can talk about this listing of Supergirl. The artwork's fine, but the whole Matrix version, I just kind of was like, all right, whatever, fine.
I love the Matrix Supergirl, but I like her after Panic to the Sky. So yeah, you get two inset pictures. You get her as like a blob, and then you get her as a blob with hair. So you get the first appearances. You get classic, and you get modern. The original one was Superman number 16 from April. Oh, I'm sorry. I take that back. You do not get the original. I'm so sorry.
No, you get the two Matrix versions.
You get the two Matrix versions. Sorry. So you get Superman 16 and then Superman 22, all the modern era. I apologize. Anyway, written by Roger Stern, who's fantastic, of course. It's just not his fault this is so messy. And Hero Order is red. So again, you mentioned Dr. Ange. Please check out his blog, Supergirl Blog, Comic Box Commentary. Or you could watch the Supergirl TV show if you want more Supergirl. Not Matrix necessarily, but that. Up next is an amazing Ty Templeton drawing of Maxwell Lord. I absolutely adore this. We've covered it already, but we get the border correction of supporting cast. There we go. That's all you really need. Just know that it's so beautiful, it deserves to be printed twice. Up next is Monarch. This is a pretty cool image by Dan Jurgens and Dick Giordano. It's Monarch, the evil, evil bad guy, dictator from the year 2030. And he's sitting in this massive computer technology chair, and he's watching a million banks of monitors. And I can't tell whether he's sitting like a boss or he's sitting looking exhausted. I don't know which, but either way, he looks pretty darn cool. What do you think? I know you're not a fan of this storyline and character and all that jazz, but what do you think of the drawing? How's it look?
It's fine. It's just a guy in an armored suit. I mean, Dan Jurgens and Dick Giordano, good combination. As we've said many times, anything with Dick Giordano is a good combination. I do wonder why you have 20 monitors with nothing on them. That seems kind of a waste. I guess he can't decide what to watch from all of his streaming channels. He's just right. Sitting there like, okay. But it's fine. I mean, my God, he's a character – it involves Hawk and Dove. I mean, how much can you really say?
I think with the monitors, Dan just drew him and figured that Dick Giordano would fill him in, and Dick Giordano is like, hell no, I'm not.
But that would not be Dick Giordano's job. So if Dan Jurgens did that, shame on him, because that's not Giordano's job to do.
So you do get the created by credit, Archie Goodwin and Dan Jurgens. Again, that's for Armageddon 2001, which was a summer annual it was a crossover summer event in the annuals, I should put it that way. The gist of it is, this story took place in 1991, and they knew at some point in the year 2001, 10 years in the future, a superhero would become a bad guy named Monarch. Then in 2010, he would conquer the world, and by 2030, he was the absolute dictator. So Wave Rider came back in time to try and figure out who was this hero who goes bad and try and change it. Well, it got very, very complicated, very, very confusing. What you essentially got was each annual was almost like its own what-if story, which is pretty cool. There are some really good stories there. But the Armageddon story, Armageddon 2001, issue number two itself, lands with like a lead balloon. The gist of it is Monarch kills Dove. And Hawk gets so angry that he kills Monarch. Well, when he kills Monarch, he finds out, oh no, I am Monarch. So Hawk figures out that he is Monarch in the future, so he then fulfills his destiny in 1991 and becomes Monarch right then and there, which is just a ridiculous snake eating his own tail. And everyone knows it was supposed to be Captain Atom, not Hawk. It got changed the last minute. In fact, you and I did an interview with Dan Jurgens, and we put him on the spot and asked him, and he said, yeah, it was supposed to be Captain Atom. I mean, not that it was a secret, not like we cracked the code, We're not Woodward and Bernstein, but it's just, Dan freely admits it. So, first appearance, again, Armageddon 2001. It's written, this entry is written by Robert Greenberger. Sort of interesting they didn't get Dan Jurgens to write it, but oh well. And the border is black for villain. And at this point, if you wanted more on Monarch, on the shelves at the same time was Armageddon Alien Agenda number 4, which is known in the comic book industry as a piece of trash. Alien Agenda, everyone hates Alien Agenda. So. If you want more, though, on Armageddon 2001, which in and of itself was really good up until that final issue, you can check out DCOCD. They talk about it there. You can check out our buddy Aaron Head Moss on his Head Speaks podcast. They covered a lot of the Armageddon 2001 stuff. And then Clinton Robinson actually ran a blog a long time ago called Armageddon 2001 Revisited. So all of that is out there for you to celebrate. Again, Armageddon 2001, great idea, really great until it couldn't stick the landing. Up next, the new Challengers of the Unknown, drawn by Tim Sale. Now, I know where you're going to go saying they shouldn't have messed with a formula that worked, but what do you think of this art piece? You've got Rocky, who's it looks pretty bruised up, or like a bruiser. You've got Ace, who's now got long hair and a goatee and an earring. And then you've got Red, who is sitting there with a giant gun. So what do you think of this drawing by Tim Sale?
I categorically did no. I have nothing to do with this. All right. Tim Sale, he is one of those guys who I think really, oh man, I hate to say this. I really do. I have nothing against the guy. I really think he does not know how to draw.
Wow.
But he was able to manipulate his style in a way that he was able to kind of put that across in a way that a lot of people liked. I know he did the Superman series and the Batman series, and I think he evolved over time to where it, in a lot of ways, I think with like McFarlane, where I just think he kind of figured out a way to make it work for people who like his work, and good for him. I don't begrudge anybody that, but I look at this piece and I'm like, this is butt ugly. This is
ugly
piece in every conceivable way, putting completely aside the idea that it's a 90s, the new badass Challengers of the Unknown. Like, no, just let it. No.
Wow. No. See, I'm tempted. This entry is written by Jeff Loeb and the art's by Tim Sale. And they've had a lot of successes together. You named off the DC ones. I don't know if you know, they're well known for having an entire Marvel series of stories called their Color Editions.
Right, the Spider-Man Red or Spider-Man Blue, whatever. Daredevil Yellow.
Exactly. It's Spider-Man Blue. I like Spider-Man Red, Spider-Man Blue, kind of like Superman Red and Blue. That would have been funny. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, and those were really good. Like the Daredevil Yellow is enjoyable. A lot of these are really great. So it almost, and the keyword's almost, it almost makes me want to try this series because they've had so many successes and I love the Challengers of the Unknown concept, but I haven't read a great Challengers of the Unknown story yet. So it almost makes me want to try. It's on the DC app, so I've thought about it. The gist of it is the Challenges of the Unknown existed exactly as you would think they did, you know, basically just like the Fantastic Four run out there kicking ass without powers. And an explosion rocks Challenger Mountain, and the Professor and June both die. A year later, the remaining members get back together, and they're very changed people at this point. Rocky has become very strategic, and he's their leader now. Ace, who was always known as the pilot, is now a mystic, and Red is a raging weapons expert. And the Professor and June are hanging around as ghosts. So the setup sounds interesting. Wow. Okay. All right.
Stupidest goddamn thing ever.
Oh my god.
That is so stupid. That is no. Okay.
Wow. All right. So anyway, man, you get your first appearance, which is a showcase number 6 in 1957, which is amazing. Then you get the new team. This is interesting. The new team, their first appearance is Challengers of the Unknown, number 7. So that means the first 6 issues of that series, they were not a team. So that also sort of piques my interest. But anyway, at this point, their series had been over for about 4 months. And so this was sort of the follow-up piece of that. Because one of the previous interests we did was like a tease before the story began. So anyway, folks, let us know in the comments if I should waste my time reading the comic. So there we go. Up next, Oh, my God.
Here we go.
Wow. Jack Kirby stuff is just getting blown up in this thing, man. New Gods by Steve Rude. Are you freaking kidding me?
Oh, boy.
Seriously? It is so damn good. It's there's a giant boom tube, and your new Genesis characters are come flying out at you. You've got Orion and Light Ray. You've got Forager, Fastback, the Black Racer, Highfather, and Metron, and they're all flying at you. And if that's not like the most iconic version of Light Ray I've ever seen, I can't think of anything else. It looks so amazing.
It's outstanding. It's completely outstanding. And Steve Rude, I'm not the first person to say this. But Steve Rude is one of the few artists who is able to channel Kirby without copying Kirby. He's got the energy. He's got the kind of weird blockiness. He's able to get the ink lines down, even though Kirby didn't ink himself. But it's he's not aping Kirby, but it's Kirby-esque in the best possible way. And much like we said with Forever People, I feel like you could just print this out and be like, this is my pitch for the New Gods animated series. And someone's like, yep, I'm bought it.
Right.
What do you need me to do?
Green light.
Yeah, green light. I mean, this is so marvelous. I love Black Racer's kind of like off kilter. I love Orion. He's like, that's great. I love Metron's body language hanging back. It tells you so much about the characters in just one image.
Yeah.
It makes me sad that they didn't get Steve Rude to do more of these because he's Steve Rude. But if they, just did the one, at least they got this one because this is just great.
Yeah. I do like Black Racer's got his pull out and like Fastback's like dodging it.
He's yeah.
Like, whoa.
Great. Yeah. Yep.
And yeah, look at Forager, the body language there, like leaping like a bug. You know, it's, oh, God, so good. So good. And so this focuses again on the, even though it says New Gods, it really focuses on the new Genesis characters. You know, we just named off all those characters. They talk about Supertown, all that stuff. It's just gorgeous. By the way, you mentioned something interesting about Steve Rude channeling Kirby without aping him. He basically said that in an interview about the Mr. Miracle special that he did.
Right. There's a reason why they hired him to do it.
Yeah. I think I'm trying to remember what the actual name of the special was. I can't remember exactly. Chris and I covered it for our Summer Spectacular one time.
Isn't it just Mr. Miracle special?
It might have been.
Yeah.
But it was Steve Rude doing a lot of Kirby stuff.
Yes.
But not trying to copy him. Yeah, it's gorgeous. Anyway, so this is entries written by Mark Waid. The entry border is red for new Hero Team. And the first appearance listed, of course, is New Gods number one from 1971. And the New Gods, sadly, the New Gods series had been over for about six months at this point. So if you want more on the New Gods, of course, check out the Kirby cast. Actually, interestingly enough, I've got a bit of a tangential relationship with this because Orion and Light Ray are about to join Justice League International. Mm-hmm. So we're about to have them. And, if it ever happens, I seriously doubt, but there was talk of a New Gods movie at one point, so that'd be nice if it happened.
I think isn't that off the table now?
I think it probably is, but I like to pretend. I like to pretend. So
okay.
All right, up next is Phantasm. So Phantasm is a character from New Titans. This was a very contemporary piece right here because the stuff's going on actually this month. The same month this issue comes out, there's some stuff going on with Phantasm. Essentially, what he appears to be is just this floating brown cloak without a body underneath, just as if there is a body, like a ghost. There's a hockey mask as a face and then some gloves, and that's all you see. And in this case, it's floating in a graveyard. It is done by Tom Grummet and Al Vey, so you know it's amazing. Logo's a little weak. That's okay. But I love this image. I know you probably don't know the first damn thing about the character or care, but what do you think about the art here?
Well, I enjoyed him in the movie, Batman Mask of the Phantasm. That was really, really good.
All right.
No, this is a great – I love the design. The floating gloves is great. And, yeah, as you said, Grummet. Really can't go wrong with Tom Grummet. He looks really cool. I really didn't know anything about him. And then I flipped the page over and I saw that he pulls his mask off and he's Danny Chase. I'm like, oh, well, then F this whole character. But
I've got an answer to that.
I know he's not. I know he's not just Danny Chase. This is an iteration of him. But the design's really cool. I think it looks really cool, and it's a nice moody piece. So I don't know much about the character, but the image is solid.
Well, here's the interesting thing: Marv Wolfman during the Titans hunt, he hid Danny Chase in the story. Basically, Danny Chase disguised himself as the Phantasm.
Oh,
everyone, well, hold on. Everyone very quickly realized that the Phantasm was infinitely much more interesting than Danny Chase himself. So they killed Danny Chase and kept the Phantasm is what they did. So now it's all coming together this month in New Titans right now, basically. At this point, Phantasm becomes this spectral force. It was a combination of Danny Chase's sort of spirit with Raven's mother and the Azareth cult, whatever, from the Raven stuff. And so he's basically just like a ghost is really all he is. The Danny Chase part of it's not even irrelevant anymore. So he just becomes this cool ghost-like character. It's a really interesting concept for a character who I think had a hell of a lot of potential. Unfortunately, Marv Wolfman was going through his writer's block phase at this point, and the character just faded away. But I think that they really could have done something with him on like a Justice League Dark team or something like that. I mean, there's no reason this character couldn't have come back and been around. It would have worked. Now, interesting, you get the first appearance of New Titans number 73 for Phantasm. You don't get a Danny Chase first appearance, which I thought was interesting.
Eh, nobody cares.
Right. The writer here is Marv Wolfman. He doesn't do a lot of pieces, but he did this one. The border is red for Hero. Could have been purple for Supernatural if they wanted. Again, New Titans 84 is on the shelves at this point. If you want more on Titans, you can listen to Titan of the Defense podcast, or Pop Culture Affidavit covers a lot of the stuff. So a missed opportunity with the character, folks. Up next is The Pied Piper by Greg LaRocque and Jose Marzan Jr. And I'm actually covering this month the Justice League Europe issue, also inked by Jose Marzan. And I think I've come to the realization I don't like him as an inker in this day and age, all right, in 1982 kind of time frame. I feel like this is a good piece that the inking didn't support. He's standing – I don't know where he's supposed to be standing.
Yeah, the background is – perplexing to me.
Yeah, he's blowing his horn and you sort of see the weird magical power of his horn above him, or it's a crack in the ceiling, I don't know which, and then there's these weird shadowy people behind him behind a bunch of splatter paint. I don't know. Again, I really like Greg LaRocque, and this is not a terribly impressive piece.
I like the main figure, but the background is so strange that it's distracting.
Yeah.
The main image. But overall, the logo is great. I love the logo.
Okay, yeah.
That's clearly from the olden days. They didn't make – nobody's spending money just to hire a letterer to do – Todd Klein to do a Pied Piper logo. But no, I dig that. It's like half a really great piece.
Yeah. So at this point, this entry is really more of an update to shift the Pied Piper from the villain category to the supporting cast character. For Flash, for Wally West specifically. They talk about his spoiled lifestyle growing up and how he was deaf, and they use sonic stuff to give him back his hearing. He used that to turn to the thrill of crime. Eventually, Barry Allen dies. Sorry, spoilers. And Hartley, who's Pied Piper, at that point reforms, and he starts helping homeless people. And he becomes very good friends with Wally West, and he actually becomes a supporting character in the book. Now, to quote the entry here, they say he is comfortable and open about pursuing a gay lifestyle. And I find that it's worth noting, though, because this is one of the first comic book characters I remember who were openly gay, but it wasn't a big deal. They didn't make a big deal about, oh, look, here's a gay character. It was just one facet of a whole person. And so I like that aspect of the character that they – didn't try and go, oh, look, we're doing, you know, tokenism. We're doing representation. No, he's just – this is who he is. And I always like that about the character.
I know they totally meant well, but just pursuing a gay lifestyle just sounds funny.
Okay.
A gay lifestyle. Like, oh, I think I'll pursue my gay lifestyle now. Just what? But that, yeah, like you said, this is – you have to remember the context. This is 1990. This is way ahead of the curve in superhero comics.
And that's fair. The writing here is, a good point about that. I just meant in the comics. So.
Oh, totally. No, yeah, you have to remember the context of it, sure.
Interestingly enough, the text here is written by Mark Waid, who was not writing The Flash yet. But in 2 months' time, he was going to be. So he was already laying all the groundwork for his Flash era, which, of course, is legendary. At this point, Flash was on issue 60 on the shelf. So, again, right away from that. It does list Pied Piper's first appearance as issue 106 from 1959. Oh my gosh, that goes way back. And he's a blue border for supporting cast. And if you want more on the Pied Piper, just go watch the TV show, people. Goodness gracious. All right, up next is Prince Evilo. And Rob, I will rest your mind at ease. This is supposed to be a funny piece. This is not taking itself the evil Prince Evilo seriously. It is supposed to be silly and funny.
It feels like a name that really should have been a Masters of the Universe character. And
it probably was.
Had it first.
Yeah. art by Craig Hamilton and Tony Harris.
Yeah.
Wow. What an unusual combination of two different artists. I want to, you know, when we went to HeroesCon, weren't there booths right next to each other? I want to say.
I don't remember that.
I just wonder if they're buddies or something. Anyway, really neat piece. I mean, the guy looks bizarre. He looks like, I don't know, he's dressed for a court duke from, I don't know, the 1600s or something, except that his hands are glowing and he's got kind of a demonish kind of face and his hair sticky up. And a cool logo, like totally boss looking logo. And there's some spatial stuff going on, but it's a weird contrast between, and Giffen loved to do this kind of stuff in the 5YL stuff, put people in like, a royal court outfit from the 1600s, but put him in a space setting. He loved doing that. What's your take on this piece? I'm curious.
It's a great piece. I love Craig Hamilton. I always have, you know?
Right.
It's funny. We have him and Jerome K. Moore in the same issue, the two guys that Jerome K. Moore replaced Craig Hamilton on the second Aquaman miniseries that never actually happened.
Okay.
No, this is a great piece. This character just – whatever. I don't care about the character. I like that his group affiliation is the Devil's Dozen. That's a funny
Well, that's the great thing about it is it's the Devil's Dozen. And they even pointed out here, it only has six members though, which is hilarious. He always intended to add more. The whole entry is written very tongue in cheek. They talk about how his daughters are crushing on the Legion, and they're crushing on Polar Boy, something fierce, which makes him even madder because they're his enemies. And basically what is it? There was an issue about a year ago at this point where he was the main bad guy and he was up against Matter Eater Lad and Calorie Queen. And it was hilarious. It was really funny. And that's really what this is leaning on. They talk about how these zombies attack, and amongst the zombies are his previous 12 wives, which is like, you know, the last thing you really want. So it's funny, tongue in cheek. It's fun, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it opens with parents who think it doesn't really matter what they name their children, only need the example of Prince Evilo. So right there.
And you see him getting angry, and he's growing horns out of his head when he gets angry. And you see him down there with the very sexy Saturn Queen as is his 12th wife and things like that. So anyway, it's a fun entry written by Tom and Mary Beerbaum. And borders black for villain, of course. First appearance goes all the way back to 1966, Adventure Comics 350. I doubt he was a joke back then, but no. he's a punchline now. And for more on him, check out the Legion of Super Bloggers, of course. Up next is Rampage by Carrie Gammell and Joe Sinnott. What an interesting combination. I adore this. I mean, she's essentially like an orange She-Hulk. You gotta know that going in and accept that. The logo looks great. She's pushing apart these two, you know, these giant metal or concrete structures. And she's, you know, again, orange She-Hulk in sort of a blue, scaly, one-piece bathing suit kind of thing. With a giant red mohawk. I think this looks great. I love Carrie Gammell. Joe Sinnott's an interesting choice to ink for him here. I think it looks great.
I know nothing of this character, but Carrie Gammell, again, like Tom Grummett, very underrated, wonderful superhero artist, and it makes this character look really cool. You know, it's great action, and the logo's really good, and she looks very imposing. So, yeah, it's a great piece.
Yep. And it was created by, you know, it doesn't say created by Jack Kirby, but it's worth mentioning. Her secret identity is Kitty Faulkner, who's a scientist for Star Labs. So basically, kind of imagine a Jeanette Clyburn type character turned superhero. It's kind of what you got here.
And the inset, there's an appearance by your beloved Starman.
Well, that's what I'm getting to. Rampage is a Superman character, supporting character, make no doubt about it. But for me, she will always be a supporting character for the Will Payton Starman series. Because, yes, she moves out to Phoenix to work at Star Labs there, and she becomes a regular reoccurring character in the Starman series as long as Roger Stern's writing it, which is great. And it talks about her origin here after some initial problems of, like, very, again, very She-Hulky kind of stuff. She eventually gets control of the transformations and actually retains her mental faculties when she's Rampage now. And she stayed out in Arizona with Will Payton for a while. Then Roger Stern leaves the book. He's back on Superman. And Starman at this point was unfortunately only 1 month away from cancellation. So by this point, Kitty Faulkner had been moved back to the Metropolis Star Labs. I guess so Roger Stern could continue writing her. I'm not sure. But neat character. I always liked her quite a bit. And again, to me, she's a Starman adjacent character as far as I'm concerned. So. Again, I already mentioned Starman's about to be canceled at this point. And for more on Rampage, you should check out Michael Bailey's. Again, pretty much any show he's ever been on for Superman stuff. And also Starman Manhunter Adventure Hour. So, all right. Up next is Talia. How do you say it?
I've always said Talia, but because when they said it on the cartoon series or in Dark Knight Rises, I believe they said Talia.
There we go. We'll go with that. Art by Jerry Bingham. She's standing there fluffing her hair in like a red tight suit.
Is that what she's doing? I can't really – I can never really tell what what she's supposed to be doing.
She could be fluffing her hair, or maybe she's putting a sword back into a sheath in her back. That'd probably be cooler.
I guess so, yeah.
But you know, she's standing there holding a giant assault rifle, and she's clearly just murdered a room full of people because she's a badass with the League of Assassins. It's a nice drawing. I don't find it terribly exciting, and I don't necessarily see Talia in that face from the Talias I've seen represented, but the drawing is executed well. I just don't find it terribly exciting.
Executed. Well done, Chick.
Thank you. Your thoughts?
It's fine. It's fine. The entry that Wade writes, first of all, clearly the Batman graphic novel where she gives birth to Batman's son has been completely retconned out because they don't mention it at all.
Yes,
here.
That is correct.
That's out. That's out of continuity. But there's this, the final paragraph, the Batman is unquestionably Talia's one true love, but her true loyalty is to Ra's al Ghul. Well, those two sentences are mutually contradictory. Like, she can't really be his true. And the image of her sort of proudly standing there, having just gunned down, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like 9 guys. To me, it's like, why would Batman love someone who does this? Like, it doesn't, it's a very violent image, even though we're coming in after the slaughter. But to me, it's like, I think it's a hard sell saying, oh God, Batman is like so in love with her when she's clearly like a mass murderer. Like, this is something Batman would never tolerate, even if these are bad guys. So I just think that's a curious choice of image to suggest that she is, you know, Batman's one true love.
Well, it's interesting. In the very first sentence of the thing says, if ever there was a woman worthy of Batman's love, it's Talia.
Yeah, which the woman is sort of gunned down 9 guys on the previous side of the page.
Well, you remember the Catwoman entry, there was some similar kind of, not about being the one true love, but about the importance of the relationship. So they're definitely new. I think that one was, I don't know if it was written by Mark Waid or not. I'm not going to go back and look. But either way, there's definitely some... Okay, there's some parallels going on here between Talia and Catwoman's entries.
He writes that for every Batman female entry.
I think if
there was one true lover.
Oh, Catwoman. My gosh. I just think it was kind of on purpose. But again, this sort of spurred my question about earlier, you know, who is Batman's one true pairing? And I don't think it's either one. I don't think I've actually read I don't know if I've read any, actually, Batman stories with Talia. I'm not sure. I don't really remember her showing up in the 90s much
at
all.
You've never read the Ra's al Ghul stories from...
I've never read those, believe it or not. I'm more familiar with her during the President Lex storyline. She was running Lex Luthor's companies for him when Lex was president. She was running LexCorp and stuff like that. I remember her from there, and I've seen her certainly in cartoons and stuff like that, but I don't get this character, I guess, because I've just never really spent a lot of time with her.
Did you see The Dark Knight Rises?
Oh, yeah, that's true. Okay. That was Talia, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I liked her in that movie, certainly. Okay. I like that. I'm a sucker for that actress, though.
Marianne Cotillard, yes.
Yeah. No creator credit. That's interesting.
I really would have
thought that would have been there, you know? But anyway, you know, first appearance, Detective Comics number 411 from May 1971. The border is black for villain, of course. And writer is again Mark Waid. I would be interested, folks, in the comments, tell me the appeal of Talia and why you think she's, you know, the one true pairing for Batman, or why you don't think she is. So it'd be interesting to hear. And of course, you know, we already talked about all the various places you can find Batman stuff. So go check those out.
As written, I will say, as written in the original run of stories, she's much more alluring Batman would fall for her, as opposed to later stories where they turned her more into like an assassin, like you see here.
Okay. Interesting. All right. You know, I probably should dig those out. I either probably have bought a trade with them or they're on DC Universe. So
they're guaranteed they're somewhere.
Oh yeah. Up next is Uncle Sam, drawn by David A. Williams and Carl Kessel. I love this thing because Uncle Sam is handed his hat and jacket to the soldier behind him, and he is rolling up his sleeves because he is about to go kick somebody's ass. I love it. You know, he's. His look on his face is a little bit determined, a little bit like, oh, you're about to get it. You know, with a smirk, like he knows he's got the upper hand. All the soldiers are behind him holding the flag. I already told you I'm a sucker for patriotic stuff. I love this. I like this entry. I think it's fun.
Yeah, it's great. The text is by Matt Wagner, which is really what he didn't draw it, though. That seems a little like why?
Okay.
What?
We got to talk about that. Like, okay. You go ahead. If you want to talk about the Matt Wagner piece, otherwise I'll chime in on.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm just curious as to why he wrote it but didn't draw it. Because, I mean, Matt Wagner, as far as I know, really only drew his own work, right?
No, he didn't. Yeah, about this point, he was really getting into writing.
Oh, okay.
In fact,
right.
Sandman Mystery Theater, which is probably
right
around the corner from this, was his.
Right.
I think, because this piece goes into a lot of detail about Uncle Sam. And I'll talk about some of that in just a minute. I don't remember any of that ever appearing in any comics. So I think this is Matt Wagner's pitch for an Uncle Sam story, is what I think this actually is. We've seen this every once in a while where there's an entry that's just kind of out of the blue and the text like, really? What's that? And then usually it's like, I don't know, Damian Whiter or someone writes in and goes, oh, well, I've got a catalog from 1992 that says I'm coming to blah, blah. You know, and please tell me that, guys. I think you guys probably have this information that I couldn't find when I Google like crazy. I think this is Matt Wagner's pitch for an Uncle Sam story. I really do.
I wonder if this led to the 2-issue miniseries by Alex Ross.
Well, I looked at that. Alex Ross had a writer with him, but it wasn't Matt Wagner.
No, it wasn't. James Hudnall, yeah. I think.
You might be right. I can't remember. But that's a few years away. So I think he tried, and it just didn't come together. Basically, it goes through and talks a lot about pilgrims, the colonies, the Revolutionary War, the foundation of the United States it talks about. And what they really point out is when Uncle Sam comes into existence, his vitality has waxed and waned as the United States has struggled with civil liberties for all and its unity.
Wonder how he's doing now.
Well, seriously, this is like the character for today. He talks about how World War II, ever since that and the nuclear attacks in the 1950s, Uncle Sam's power has actually been fleeting and unpredictable. And they specifically say, their words, not mine, guys, he is powered by human ideals of freedom and liberty, not oppressive nationalism. I mean, wow.
Right
there on the page, man. I do like that. This is a little bit separate part. It says, as it's talking about how his creation and all this stuff, it says, as with most legends, some of this is almost, some of this is almost certainly true, but none of it is factual. I like that because there's a truth between truth and facts. That's mm-hmm. kind of a nice way to put mm-hmm. it, especially when you're talking about a legend. So it's an interesting piece, and I would have liked to have read this comic. Now, there's also someone might write in and go, oh, no, this was all explained in an issue of, I don't know, Batman and the Outsider or something. Maybe that's the case, but I don't think –
Batman and the Outsider.
I know.
Where it was.
I don't think that's the case, folks. I think this was Matt Wagner's vision for what Uncle Sam could be, and I find it kind of interesting. It's a fairly bleak picture. But I think it might have been an interesting story. And as you said, you know, Alex Ross took it down to a fairly bleak Uncle Sam story, too.
Yeah, I like everything about this. I like the text. I like the artwork by David, as you mentioned, David Williams and Carl Kiesel. I'm not familiar with David Williams, but I like the cartooniness. I love his giant Popeye forearms on the main image. I like that the inset is a gloss on the I want you image because he's pointing. Mm-hmm. I like him punching a Nazi because that's what you're supposed to do. You see a Nazi.
Is that a Nazi? I wasn't sure.
Yeah. Yes. He's got the jacket.
I didn't know if it was Hirohito or if it was a Nazi. I couldn't tell.
He's got the jack boots. I think he's supposed to be a Nazi. If you see a Nazi, it's your patriotic duty to punch them. So, I mean, good job, Uncle Sam. This is taking an obscure character and kind of doing something really cool with it. So, this is a good listing.
First appearance in National Comics number 1, July 1940.
Which is not a DC comic, by the way.
That's true. That's a good point. We already talked about the rest of it. Border is red for hero. So
good
interesting,
piece.
Interesting piece. Up next is the Zamorons. This is one of the rare alien entries. The piece is it's by David A. Williams again.
Again, time, two in a row.
This time inked by Carl Story. I think the image is nice. The women are beautiful. They look very tough. The warrior women, they look aggressive with their giant spears and shields and all this stuff and their giant headpieces. It doesn't say space, though, to me. I mean, yes, there's space behind them, but it doesn't say space warrior women to me. It just says Greek warrior women to me. I don't know. Just me?
Yeah, just you. They're in outer space. Come on. What are we supposed to do?
Or it's just the night sky.
No, they're cooked. All right. Do you see these planets from the night sky?
Oh, okay. So I guess there's a few of them there, aren't there?
All right. Come on.
Anyway, I don't need to talk a lot about the Zamorans. We've talked about them a bunch of times. You guys all unfortunately read Millennium. I'm sorry for that. But there is some real meta in here, which I kind of picked. I've read their origins a bunch of times. But it talks about how, you know, they were paired with the Owens, meaning the Guardians, and then they split up, right? The way it's written here, I'm going to paraphrase. They basically explain that the men were investing too much time in their hobbies to the detriment of their own bodies. While the women worked towards physical perfection, and the women grew tired of the men ignoring them, and the women left. That's kind of summarizes what happened here. I get the feeling like some Silver Age or Bronze Age writers got, you know, felt like jilted lovers or something, or taking it out on their ex-wives or something is what I'm thinking. Like, you know, some nerd spent all his time writing comic book scripts and their beautiful wife left them and now they're angry and they're making that story. I don't know.
All you guys listening to this, it could happen to you.
So, and of course, they talk about Star Sapphire and all that stuff. And they talk about Millennium, how the Owens and the Zamorans get their groove back on, right? But check out this last bit. This is crazy. So they go off, right, to go make space babies, right, of the next generation. And the Guardians eventually came back. The Zamorans, at least at this point, I guess, hadn't. And it says, the Guardians have since returned to this universe to help reestablish the Green Lantern Corps. When the Zamorans have completed their time of gestation, they will join the Guardians of Oa. What the hell? Seriously? And then Mark Waid just leaves a whole column blank. Like, really? Wow. That just kind of took me back.
The graphic designer in me really hates that one half sentence in the third column.
Right.
Like, you couldn't trim the text a little or increase the text just to not have it hanging there. It just looks very, very awkward.
Or put a drawing in there, you know, or something, right?
Dude, put something there. Run an ad for the Great Superman movie contest or something. Put something in there.
Well, also the top, you just get the first appearance of Green Lantern number 16 in 1962. Yep. And there's all that white space there, too.
Yep.
All right, so written by Mark.
I do like the inset of, is that Martian Manhunter in Martian form staring at the camera?
Oh, my God, it is. It is, it probably. That's hilarious. I didn't notice that. Looking at the camera going, hey, guys. So here's the best part. Rob, I want you to take a good look at the Zamorans, because besides the fact that they're hot, just take a good look at them and their skirt and everything, okay?
All right.
I got my reasons. Then go on to the next entry, which is Ambush Bug, folks. Ambush Bug is the last entry in Who's Who, the first Loose Leaf edition. And he is surrounded by all these costumes. And what's he taking off, Rob?
The Zamorin costume.
He's taking off the Zamorin skirt. Exactly. And he's got a girdle on. So, and his legs are painted flesh color. So, yeah. So Ambush Bug is surrounded by all these costumes of all these different characters from Who's Who. You see Superman's, you know, cape. You see Granny Goodness's wig. You see Red Tornado's helmet piece. You see Uncle Sam's hat. You see signs that say, like, Mara's mugshot, issue number 12. You see Wonder Woman's hat and tiara. Anyway, and Ambush Bug's taking off the Zamorin costume, and he's going, oh, yeah, right. Like, you really thought they all had time to pose for these things. So the implication is that throughout all these issues of Who's Who, it was Ambush Bug in different costumes posing as the characters, which is freaking brilliant. Oh, my God. It's so funny. What a great way to end it. You've got in the background. I mean, they went out – Keith Giffen, by the way, here, drew this with Al Gordon. He went out of his way to really bring in stuff from the – like, you know, he's got Lobo's knee pad, you know, that appeared on the Who's Who entry. You've got even the Nort background. Like, if you look under the word bug, you can see that is the top part of the Nort entry. Like, literally what the entry looked like. So they really went all out to do this stuff. I love this thing.
And, of course, he is the only person who gets a comic book character border.
And what's his border color?
It's the Go-Go Checks.
Yes! Oh, my gosh. Oh, it's so brilliant. It's so good. Oh, my gosh. The creator credits Keith Giffen. I'm going to read some of the bio data. Occupation, Who's Who runway model. Known relatives, you get cheeks. You get group affiliation, none. Sob. Base of origin, or base of operations, DC Comics, but I try harder. You get height, 1 inch to 9 inches, depending on the size of the panel. Weight, get real. Hair everywhere. Eyes, too. I mean, it's just funny. You know, it was written by Robert Lauren Fleming, who was Keith Giffen's partner in the series. The inset pictures are just It's just his head, and they just keep rotating it. They put two of them, like, you looking at me? I mean, it's just stupid and funny. Oh, God. And his origin is just totally goofball. They write this ridiculous origin. It's like a fake Kryptonian kind of origin about how the costume leaves this planet in a rocket ship. Then they, interestingly enough, they mention specifically Lois Lane number 48 inspired him to be a superhero, I guess. I almost wonder if that's Robert Loren Fleming saying, like, that's the first comic you read. I'm not really sure. But it's also written all in first person.
Yep.
To demonstrate that he knows he's in a comic book. So, just so damn fun.
I love on the front page, you didn't mention, we see Cheeks the Toy Wonder. He's still sitting.
Oh, yeah. He's in the mirror. Very appreciate it.
He's in the mirror. Yeah. This is a perfect way to end it. Perfect way to end the series.
So good. I love Mara got mentioned. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think, is that
the hat from American Scream? Is that what it's supposed to be?
Either the hat from American Scream or the hat from the Uncle Sam entry a couple of pages ago. One or the other. Dude, look at the top right-hand corner. There's the fish. Isn't that the fish from the Aquaman? Well, because we kept talking about the Aquaman drawing was so-so, but the fish looked great.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, it might be.
I think it is.
Good stuff.
What an awesome way to celebrate the end of Who's Who. I mean, I just can't imagine anything better. So I absolutely adore this thing. All right, Rob, I ask you every issue, name your standout characters, art-wise, or entries, I guess, from the issue.
Okay, art-wise, my favorites, let's see. My absolute favorites are the Forever People.
Crazy. How crazy is that?
Forever People. The Legion of Superheroes, Major Victory. I'm not counting Maxwell Lord because it's a repeat.
Right.
Certainly New Gods.
Yeah.
And Uncle Sam. I think those are my favorites.
I would like everyone to please take note of the date and write it down. Rob just said Legion of Superheroes is his favorite. So my favorites include Catwoman, Cosmic Odyssey, of course, the Forever People, of course, Legion of Superheroes, Major Victory. I think it looks great. You mentioned New Gods. I love the Phantasm. I think it looks great. I think Rampage looks great. And I got to mention Ambush Bug. I can't not. It's too good. So... All right, that is Who's Who in the DC Universe, I guess kind of Volume 1 is what you would call it, really, or because it's the different title slightly. Anyway, that is the Loose Leaf Edition. We have completed the first wave. We've got a lot more Who's Who goodness to come, guys. We're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we're going to cover your feedback from Issue 15.
Batman Nightcast is back with new episodes and a new mission. I'm Ryan Daly.
And I'm Chris Franklin. The new Nightcast chronicles the Dark Knight Detective's greatest adventures from our favorite comic book creators.
What a novel approach, talking about the comics we actually enjoy.
I know, right?
Highlights from this bold new era of Batman Nightcast include...
The Joker's Laughing Fish.
The Saga of Ra's al Ghul.
Is that how we're pronouncing it?
Yes.
Okay. Batman versus the Man-Bat.
And the first appearance of villains like Clayface 3 and the Ventriloquist.
Plus more great stories by the likes of Steve Englehart and Marshall Rogers.
Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams.
Alan Grant and Norm Frickin' Brayfogle.
Irv Novick.
Don Newton.
Doug Munch.
Dick Sprang.
Max Allen Collins.
No, what?
Just messing with you.
Wasn't funny.
Batman Nightcast, every month from the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
There's something like 115,000 English language podcasts in the world, and no doubt hundreds of them are aimed at the comic book genre.
There are sci-fi comic podcasts.
Horror comic podcasts.
War comic podcasts!
But do you know what we need?
Two guys crazy enough to combine those fields and make a podcast of their very own?
Yes. It's the answer to a question no one asked, so that's why we are answering it. Such a gaping hole in the podcast landscape must be filled post-haste.
Did you really just use the word post-haste?
The Weird Warriors podcast covers the Weird War Tales comic book series published by DC Comics from 1971 to 1983. Along the way, we'll also check out other horror and war comics published by DC, Marvel, Charlton, and any other targets that may present themselves to us.
I have the war books, and he has the horror books. So if you're ready to take a nice, relaxing look at the hell of war in comic book form from the age of the caveman to the distant future, then report for duty by subscribing to the Weird Warrior Podcast, brought to you by the Brothers Spleen, wherever fine podcasting provisions are issued.
Vampires!
Aliens!
Dinosaurs!
Alien dinosaurs!
There's something for everyone.
General Sherman said war is hell, but do you know what else is?
Weird.
For our purposes, yes. So tune in to the Weird Warrior Podcast today. Do it! That's an order!
Yes, sir!
Don't call me sir, I work for a living.
But we're not getting paid for this.
Dang!
Well, I'm Max.
And I'm Rich.
And we're going to be bringing you the Weird Warriors Podcast, where we will promise to make war
no more.
All right, folks, we're back with your who's, hows, and whys. First up, our iTunes reviews. Thank you so much to everyone that's been leaving us iTunes reviews lately, or I guess it's called Apple Podcast now, whatever. Anyway, sincerely appreciate those. They really help raise the profile of the show, and a lot of people find us through those. And with the omnibuses coming out, or omnibuy, whatever, with the omnibus being on the shelves, people are searching and finding us. So, Rob, why don't you kick us off?
First up is a comment from RL Sharp 77, top-notch podcast. Kudos for Rob and Shag. If you're a fan of DC Comics, this is a dream come true. Thank you, RL.
Awesome. Up next is Al Girding. He writes, a lot of fun. Shag and Rob are internet buddies starting a podcast. However, they're about to fail their comic history class, which means Shag would be sent to military school. They receive help from a time traveler from the future, where their podcast is the foundation for a perfect society. With the use of a time machine, Rob and Shag travel to various points in comic history, returning with important issues of DC Who's Who comics to help them complete their final comic history presentation. Thank you so much, Al. What you can't see right now is Rob and I are both doing air guitar.
Yeah, it would be awesome to one another.
Tell me what number I'm thinking of. 69, dude. Thank you so much, Al. That is, I laughed hysterically when that came through. Thank you so much.
We got another review from Edwin ESB Jr. Really late to the Who's Who party. Just found your podcast a few weeks ago after receiving my Who's Who omnibus. I'm really enjoying the discussions about each character, the artwork, and the art teams. Even 9-year-old podcasts are still entertaining and enjoyable. I like the friendly banter between the co-hosts.
Friendly? Really?
And find myself, Edwin doesn't know what words mean, and find myself wanting to answer their questions and provide information they don't know about characters and artists, but I'm sure many listeners already did it for me already. I've been a DC collector going back to 1974. I'm only on issue 8, and I have a long way to go to catch up, but I'm enjoying the trip down memory lane. Thank you, Edwin. And I have to say, can you imagine, like, you know, he gets his Who's Who omnibus, right? He gets this in the mail, and he's like, you probably think he's the only guy who's going to buy this thing. And then he probably just gets a kind of like a random thought. I wonder if there's a podcast about Who's Who somewhere. And then he goes and discovers there's like 60 episodes of such a show, all of which are 3 hours long. You know, I mean, imagining if you start to like it, you're like, oh, this is manna from heaven, you know, because you're like, no one would expect that there would A, be a show about the subject, and B, there would be 10,000 hours of
content. Right. I mean, the fact is, this show shouldn't work. I mean, Rob even talked about at the beginning, the original format was not like we intended. This thing shouldn't work at all, but folks, it's you at home that make it work. Because it's just Rob and I talking about characters. But when you guys start adding, I mean, the feedback section alone, it could be its own show. It's so awesome. So, I mean, by the way, 78 comments on the last episode. I compiled it, 27 pages of comments. You guys
never
are
ends.
Insane and awesome and everything above. So welcome to the club, Edwin, and you're part of the family. And I look forward to you telling me why Matt Wagner wrote all that about Uncle Sam. So when you in about 8 years when you get caught
right,
up.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're covering the feedback right now from issue number 15 of Loose Leaf from our website comments and our emails. Again, reminder, we get so many comments now that we're just doing the iTunes reviews, the website, and emails. And we're not pulling social media. At the end, we will acknowledge everyone who shared the show. So keep doing that, please. But we're not going to be digging up all the comments on Facebook and everything like that.
Right. We did get an email from Ricky Sharp, who I imagine is the same RL Sharp who left a review. I don't know that for a fact, but I'm going to assume. And Ricky mentions, he says, well, I'll explain it in a second. He says, I received the issues of Who's Who. I cannot thank you enough. My jaw dropped when I saw the November 85 issue. This is not only my first Susu issue, but also my first DC comic I ever bought. As a 9-year-old Marvel zombie, I was amazed by all the Green Lanterns in the core and had no clue who Alan Scott was. I was blown away by the Green Lantern G.I. robot art and fell in love with the Global Guardians. Thank you for your generosity. So what Ricky is referring to is he mentioned in an email to us that he's a big fan of the show and he just discovered it. And that I think he said in a fire.
I think it was a house fire, if I remember right.
It was a house fire, yes. That he lost much of his comic collection, if not all of it, and he lost all of his Who's Who's. His original Who's Who's. And that's, of course, it's tragic. Anything to happen. I've been very fortunate. That's never happened to me or anything like that. And I have duplicates of some Who's Who's. I'm just picking them up. Every time I go to a convention, if somebody had one for like a dollar or even less than that, sometimes I buy it in a pile just to have it and give it away. And so I realized, well, I had, I think, about 6 Who's Who's duplicates, and I just sent them to Ricky. And that's what he's referring to. He got them. And of course, he's mentioning that one of the ones that I sent him was the first comic book that he ever bought. So I'm very happy to help Ricky fill back in his collection. And I'm glad that they arrived safe and sound. They're not great condition, but they're nice reading copies. And, always happy to help out a fellow Who's Who fan, especially someone who lost them in a fire. That's just the worst.
You keep doing nice things for people. It's ruining my picture of you, man.
I met Kelly and I've turned into a nicer person.
Ricky, that was my first issue of Who's Who as well. So, and again, Rob, incredibly generous of you.
I'm always happy to. People send me stuff in the mail and it's always very fun. So I like to do it too. In this digital age, everything's all emails, but you get something in the mail, it's just something special. So,
did I tell you, Rob, how I lost my Detective Comics number 27?
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Nick Vector left a comment. But by the way, I don't believe Nick Vector is his real name. I think that is a character from an 80s cartoon series about like a video game, like he's a character in a video game or something, and he comes alive. Doesn't that sound like that with Nick Vector? It would sound like that. Like,
I am outraged that you would suggest someone associated with this podcast would not use their real name.
Right, exactly.
The Irredeemable Shag is outraged at this, Rob.
One day, young Nicholas, Vector. He was playing Tempest, and then he got hit by an alien beam, and he became Nick. I don't know.
Everyone at home is humming the kid video theme right now. Just
exactly,
so you know.
Exactly. So anyway, Nick Vector says, had to stop listening after the Black Orchid entry to point this out. The Neil Gaiman story, which you both admit you didn't read, also actually revealed that the Susan Linden DNA Orchid hybrid was the original Black Orchid from the 70s. That version of Black Orchid was killed in the first issue of the Gaiman story, and her consciousness transferred into the sister orchid in Phil Sylvian's lab, which was said to be the secret headquarters of the 70s Black Orchid, with Sylvian talking about the room where she kept her computers and disguises. This event set the stage to reveal Black Orchid's origin in the rest of the miniseries. Thank you, Nick. I had no idea.
I did not either. That's one of the few corners of that issue I did not know in and out. So, yeah, thank you for that information. Now we're from Tom Panarese, our buddy from the Pop Culture Affidavit podcast and blog, and Required Reading with Tom and Stella. Tom says, is it me or does Kathy George, from Shay the Changing Man, does Kathy George have kind of a Martha Quinn's cooler sister thing going on in that entry? Yes, she did, Tom. Yes, she did. And he says, regarding Bill Jaska, there was a Bill Jaska entry in there that was pretty nice, but then I went on a rant about Bill Jaska's Teen Titan or New Titans work. And he says, Bill Jaska, yes, one of the most maligned Titans artists, but he had gotten the job because of the amount of independent work he had done, some with Marvel, as well as some X-Men and Hulk issues that had gotten praise from Peter David. I had seen some pictures of uninked, uncolored pages of the Titans book, and they are much better than what wound up on the printed page. Yeah, those Titans issues were horrible artwork. I mean, they're bad, bad. Bad. Anyway, it's nice to hear that that they were much better in reality. They just looked like mud, Rob. It was just black everywhere. It was gross. Anyway, I'm glad to hear that he was a better artist than what we got. It's a shame what happened, though.
Kevin from New Orleans says, I wish there would have been a crossover with Swamp Thing and the Suicide Squad because they are both based in Terrebonne Parish, Louisiana, and it would have been cool seeing Swamp Thing freaking out Captain Boomerang. Maybe he'll be in the movie. And we don't know.
Oh, wow. I loved those Millennium covers where had everyone – the 4 joint covers where everyone's going through the swamp. I don't think Swamp Thing was part of that covers, but I mean it's seeing the Suicide Squad and the swamp look great. They were from Gort Tolton from the Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast. I love saying that so much. Anyway, Gord Tolton calls me to task on one of the characters' names, who I'm not going to say now because I said it wrong then and I'll say it wrong again. Anyway, it was a French name, and he says, Sisko and Bosk are going to be writing you letters. So ironically, I didn't really get beat up by them, but I got beat up by everyone else in the comments. So thank you, Gord.
Matt Saroy says, another great episode, guys. It's a true testament to how entertaining you are. Thank you, Matt. I have no interest in these characters. Vertigo just wasn't my thing. I enjoyed Preacher and Swamp Thing, but too often I found these titles just too bizarre to be entertaining. Listening to Rob and Jag discuss them, it made me feel like I'd missed out.
Wow. Okay. That feels nice. They were from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, Mr. E is awesome. I got his 1970s comics back in 1989, and I liked him. He would have been great on Constantine or Arrow. So that would have been interesting, yeah. He says, she says, he was a cool character. I didn't read Books of Magic, probably for the best, though, because I like Mr. E better as a hero, though he definitely fits Vertigo. Thank you, Liz. I appreciate that. Then we heard from Diablo Frank. Frank is, of course, famous for the Fire and Water podcast DC Sampler episode and his flattering coverage of Power of the Atom. Frank goes on about Abby Holland. He talks about running into her on the Swamp Thing run and everything. He says, I thought she was attractive and dug the white hair with the black streak. However, she always seemed to be barefoot in cutoffs, and one man's hippie chick is another's white trash. That aspect reminded me too much of my childhood surroundings, so I mostly dismissed her. She's the chick who does it with She's a chick who does it with vegetables. Oh, my God. Oh, Frank. And then he says, Danny the Street had an amazing career for an inanimate object from a mature reader's title. Did you know they were extensively in the New 52 Teen Titans as their resident boom tube, though he spent much of the time merely as Danny the Alley? I had no idea. That's almost interesting. I hope it was
interesting.
The New 52 Teen Titans was a mess. There was some stories that were good, like during the Rebirth era, but then there were some other ones that were like the Scott Lobdell issues, which were horrible. I hope it was during some of the good ones. Let's put it that way.
He then says, Ken Stacy is aces on retro 50s deals. Yeah, completely. And now when he said that, how did Ken Stacy never get put on Adam Strange? That seems like a, you know, like at the very least like a listing. But man, and a Ken Stacy drawn Adam Strange miniseries. Oh my God, that would have been amazing.
That would have been really good. Yeah, you're right. He says, so the Dreaming gets an entry? Cool. Because you couldn't look up the collective unconsciousness in 1992. Or if you did, it wouldn't have had the official green location border. Frank's points, his stuff, by the way, you should go out to the website and read these things. It is hilarious. I mean, he was super on point and then super all over the place. I mean, it is hilarious. All of his comments this time. Not that they're not normally, but it just I really got a kick out of them. Anyway, then he says, we talked about Teen Titans. And we talked a lot about Teen Titans, and I talked about the Dan Jurgens run and things like that. Anyway, he says, I will not entertain revisionist history of the lame Dan Jurgens Teen Titans series. That could have been really something with the George Perez inks, but the characters and villains were worthless. I'll also note that there were numerous Titans teams that were worse than the New 52, including the aforementioned Jurgens run. Unrecognizable as some may have been, at least that book had characters anybody cared about. Other awful Titans runs include the Baxter series under Barreto, Arsenal's team, and about half of the Team Titans. So, Frank, I'm not going to argue with you here because someone else did it. I'll mention that in a second. But I do think that the Teen Titans series under Dan Jurgens had an opportunity. I think the characters were kind of interesting, but I think the comic itself wasn't interesting, was the real failing. Either way, Frank goes on about the Teen Titans with David A. Scudieres and Siskoid for miles of comments, and it essentially descends into about the equivalent of a bunch of 11-year-olds getting into a slap fight. I mean, that's
descends.
What did I say?
Well, you're saying it was descending. I'm saying I don't think it got low. I think it started there. I don't think it descended, is what I'm saying.
And it's actually, as much as I pick on them, it's really interesting reading their comments because, like, almost everyone, I'm like nodding my head, and then I'm reading the next comment, which is completely contrary to that, and I'm sort of nodding my head. It's like they all make a lot of really good points. So it's worth reading. Go out to the website and read those folks. It'll make you think about Titans a lot.
Wow. Ooh, what a motivator.
Hey.
Roger Pree from the Off the Record DVD interview says, after listening to this one thing is perfectly clear. Rob needs to watch the Doom Patrol TV show. I will say, I think after, yeah, it had to have been after the last two suits, because the last two suits was 6 years ago. I started watching the Doom Patrol TV series, and I kind of started to wonder, when does it get good? So I gave up on it. I didn't enjoy it. Sorry.
I watched the first one, and it didn't grab me. Everyone loves it.
Yeah.
I were from Eric from the Fish Flavored Baseball Bat blog. He says, one little note of trivia regarding Dana DeStreet. The name is a takeoff on a British entertainer, female impersonator called Dani LaRue. LaRue being French for the street. And he provided a link. And that is Tim Price even says that's a fascinating fact. So very interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, me neither. Mick says, as a fan of the Ennis Dillon run, meaning Hellblazer, Rob, if you love Preacher, you should seek out their work on Hellblazer. It's amazing to see the massive exposure Constantine is enjoying today. We do live in strange times, obviously. Wonderful episode, boys. Looking forward to the next Mick Jameson. Thank you, Mick. We got a comment from David S. Gutierrez, who pops in throughout the thread. And he says, regarding the Doom Patrol entries, perfect college fodder, shrooming in the room like Rob did in JKS.
Oh, my gosh.
I hear the special tea helped you draw a boss-ass horse. I think Doom Patrol had been struggling to find a hook after Morrison left. I love what the young animal creatives are doing with the series, smartly putting the focus on newer characters instead of trying to do their best Morrison riff. Like with the Invisibles, I think Morrison lets his ideas get away from him, and the outpour of ideas masks some of the more clever takes on DC's Brutos.
You know, it's interesting for sort of the renaissance that Doom Patrol is going through right now. A lot of people came down hard on Doom Patrol in the comments, especially with the Simon Bisley entries that we just couldn't stand. So, by the way, we should mention David H. Gutierrez is the corrupt chief financial officer of Katana Banana Fruit Stand. So, the word from Michael Bailey from the Fortress of Bailey Tude Podcasting Network. Michael says, Black Orchid. I forget where I read this, but apparently because of Gaiman's and Neil Gaiman's accent, Dick Giordano thought Neil Gaiman wanted to write, instead of Black Orchid, he thought he wanted to write Black Hawk Kid. Because if you say, you know, Black Orchid, that was horrible. Anyway, Black Hawk Kid is what it's supposed to, I guess it sounds like. So I just have this image of Neil saying it and Dick just staring there blankly as he tries to remember if DC ever published Black Hawk Kid. And apparently that appeared in one of Karen Berger's Meanwhile columns. So it also appeared in the trade paperback. So interesting. Then we hear from Joe X, who pointed out, last time we mentioned Zoom's Who, which was the collected edition of all the Zoom's Who entries that Zoom Yukinori produced. We provided a link to the electronic version of the whole thing. Well, he had a problem with the file, but then Adrian Zett and Usamu jumped in and helped clean up that thing. So if you need to download Who Zoom's Who, please check out the comments for the updated CBR if the original download didn't work for you.
Absolutely. Chris Franklin from Marrow Network, of course, he has a couple comments about different characters. First up, he says, the Three Witches. Tis the season, and it's also the season when Hocus Pocus is on the air every day for a month. When that film came out, I wondered if the writers had noticed DC's old Witching Hour comic, especially with the plump and sexy bitches in both, respectively. Sarah Jessica Parker's character in the film seems a lot like Cynthia here. And, how do I put this delicately, what exactly is she doing with her right hand there? Maybe it's nothing. Maybe since Jones is clearly amping up her sex appeal to 11, and this is a more mature reader's themed issue, there may be something there.
There were a lot of comments about the sexiness of the witches actually throughout the comments this time.
Yes. And then regarding Dana DeStreet, I have always suspected the figure of Cliff Steele on the back of the entry was customized from a 12-inch Captain Action Dr. Evil figure. The buggy eyes and the nose seem familiar. Maybe Taggart painted over the bloodshot veins of the original figure's eyeballs. I will always defer to Chris. He knows that stuff backwards and forwards. So that'd be pretty funny if it was a painted over Dr. Evil.
Of course Chris knows this stuff. There from Mike Cole says, thanks for another fun episode. The Loose Leaf series is definitely a time capsule of its day. Sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad. This issue showed the roots of the Vertigo line, which I love. And the Endless by Mike Dringenberg made this Sandman fanboy happy. Yeah, that's a great entry. Absolutely, Mike.
Mike Dinah says, oh boy, I fell into Hellblazer hard. Unlike Rob, Hellblazer just made complete sense, and I totally got it. From his punk roots and onward, I loved most of the series, and to this day is one of the few comics where I've gone out of my way to collect all the issues, the other being Alpha Flight, because I think it's the law if I'm Canadian.
No, yeah, you have to buy all of Alpha Flight because it's awesome.
I find, though, Constantine works best as the charlatan jerk who maybe knows magic. In fact, some of my favorite moments are when he's facing supernatural elements but handling them in a mundane way to the point that you wonder if he actually knows any magic whatsoever. I totally agree with Dag that he works great in his own corner of the universe. Since the New 52, they've tried to make him more mainstream with the other superheroes, and I find that he loses some of his magic, pun intended, that way. I could blather on about Hellblazer all day, but I won't. You kind of already did, Mike. Once again, you made an episode where I hardly know any of the characters and made it so interesting. It makes me want to track down some of these storylines. Maybe it's finally time to give Vertigo a retry. Well done, and keep up the great work. Well, thank you, Mike.
Awesome. Very complimentary. Appreciate that. You know, from Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog, Comic Box Commentary, and Illusion of Super Bloggers. Dr. Ange says, like Shag, I was in the comics are like mature, you know, it can teach you deep thinking stage of my comic reading. As you may recall in the last episode, I talked a little bit about Shade the Changing Man, Rob. I don't know if you remember that or not.
A bit, yeah.
Yeah. So he follows up. He says about American Scream, Shade, and Kathy George. Because I have already said that I love this series. And as Shag astutely points out, he says I was astute, Rob. Take a note. Anyway, And Shag astutely points out that Bachalo's art changes in front of our eyes to his more distinctive style somewhere around issue 8, I'd say. And then he says, Kathy is the standout character. She grows so much over the series, but the issues where she confronts herself over her drinking are just haunting. Seriously, everyone should read this series. Yes, Rob, you should read Shade the Changing Man.
I did read the first trade paperback, which you so generously provided me. So
you read it. You never told me you read it. Okay. You must have hated it then.
I didn't hate it. I didn't love it.
You're so broken. You're like, you know, you do all these generous things, but you're broken inside. Maybe that's why you do nice things for other people.
I don't know. The world we're living in, I'm like, ooh, American Scream. Ooh, everything's so dark. I'm like, okay.
The world we're living in is worse than the American Scream.
Yeah, exactly. It felt a little like, oh, aren't you adorable? So, okay. And then regarding Tefe, he says, I'll say it was Tefe who, in a way, made me drop the Swamp Thing comic. Rick Veitch took over writing for Alan Moore and was so decompressed. His time travel story and the Sprout story took forever. By the time it all wrapped up, I was basically done. It's a shame because hearing her be branched between the red and green does sound interesting.
That may be the only time Tefe and interesting was ever in a sentence together.
Oof.
Then Siskoid from, of course, the Fire & Water Podcast Network does shows such as Who's Editing, 0 Hour Strikes, and a whole bunch more. He says, I was a Vertigo nut. The line came at a time when those were the kinds of comics I wanted to read, and I was a completist for many years. Of course, this issue of Who's Who came out about a year before Vertigo became an actual imprint, and that's a good thing because I think we would not have gotten Vertigo as part of Who's Who after that partition closed off. You know, he makes a really good point about that. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, if this had come out after Vertigo, none of this would have been here. And then he goes on here and actually points out how once Vertigo launched, a lot of the quote-unquote classic series from the Vertigo era actually were already kind of on the way out as far as their most memorable eras. Interesting. Like Grant Morrison had left Doom Patrol, things like that. And then he says, Shade was great too. In Young Animals, Shade the Changing Girl definitely follows that continuity, but the American Scream storyline is probably more relevant today than it was then. I agree. Rob's obviously just – nothing's happening there. It's an empty balloon where his head should be. Anyway, speaking of Anacenti, hearing you describe the robot man image evoked a similar scene in Nocenti's Daredevil, the blazingly awesome Acts of Vengeance tie-in where Daredevil's up against a mountain of Ultron heads. Yeah, you make a great point there because that's a phenomenal cover by, I think, John Romita Jr., if I remember right. And yeah, I can kind of see the comparison where Richard Case's our robot men, as Rob always says. Thank you.
Dougie the Street, a.k.a. Doug Van Diver, who does the old Bolty Neck blog, says, esteemed gentlemen, the reasons I enjoy the Who's Who podcast in no particular order are Rob, Shag, the awesome theme sequence, the jokey jokes and such, my having been acquainted with at least somewhat of the characters being discussed. Well, you can't always have everything, I guess. Best 4 out of 5 is still good. Thumbs up, fellers.
There was a lot of that. A lot of folks that just weren't familiar with a lot of the stuff. But it sounds like the episode was entertaining enough to keep them interested, at least. They were from Tom Perrin. And he had asked about the theme song. We get these questions every so often, folks. And, you know, if you ever don't know one of the characters in the theme song, put it in the comments. Someone will explain it to you. In this case, Tom Panarese did. So thank you so much. They were from Damian Drought Whiter from the Should I Love This Comic podcast. Damien writes in to say, only just starting this episode. I should point out, we asked a lot about Jeff Lane or Lang last time, because Jeff Lang wrote a couple of the entries, like out of the blue, maybe even the Swamp Thing entry. I don't remember. We're like, what? Who is this guy? Anyway, he says, isn't Jeff Lang married to Nancy A. Collins? I'm sure his novels were mentioned in Swamp Thing's letter columns. Well, I looked it up. I could not validate that. It may have been the case in the 1990s. Nowadays, I know that his partner is someone named Helen instead. Now, in a weird coincidence, though, you know, I sat there the whole episode. I just kept talking about who's Jeff Lang, who's Jeff Lang, who's Jeff Lang. I found out I own some Star Trek books written by him. I had no idea. Like the same night we recorded our episode, I looked at these Star Trek books and there's his freaking name all over it. I had no idea. So small world, absolutely crazy. Then Damien goes on to say about Cliff Steele. Images like this always make me wish that Richard Case did his own covers on Doom Patrol. Because you remember, they always did Dave McKean covers. Or Simon Bisley or whatever. And he says, there was a sense of graphic design in his images which made them stand out a lot from a lot of his contemporaries. And, you know, you're right. Richard Case really was really good at design. And so I think you're right. He would have really rocked those covers. Good call. And he says, Kathy George, he goes, can I agree with Shag's love for this character? Milligan and Bachalo really made her real. Ultimately, the 75 issues of Shade were about Kathy and not Shade. Wow, I hadn't thought of it that way, but that makes a really good point, Damien. And he says about Mr. E, John K. Schneider III is a genius, and Jay Geldof supports him here well. The character design is so strong, but I have to say the miniseries this entry recounts is pretty poor. I picked the whole thing up, and it was beautiful, of course, but I felt it was ultimately empty and a bit obvious. Love the entry, though. Yeah, I mean, that's the sad thing. The Mr. E concept was great. The art was amazing. The miniseries itself, not so great.
Speaking of J.K. Snyder III, he says, Temptress, J.K. Snyder III is a genius. If he wasn't, I'd complain about the century as the character is such a mort.
Well, she was insanely sexy too, though. They were from Paul Hicks from the Waiting for Doom podcast, DC, OCD, and more. Because I'm not a particular fan of the Simon Bisley Doom Patrol villains in this piece, but it does capture the spirit of the book. And now the Richard Case stuff is timeless. I totally agree with you, Paul. And hey, you're the Doom Patrol expert, so I trust you. And it's a Shag, I would appreciate as a special favor to me that you ask Rob his thoughts on Shade the Changing Man every 5 minutes on a podcast you do together from now on. So, Rob, did you like the trade?
As I told you earlier, I thought it was fine. I liked some of it, and other parts I just was like, eh, okay. I love the artwork, though. The artwork is great.
Well, if you keep going, Bachalo becomes even better. So, yeah.
Okay. All right.
They were from Nicholas Alheim, a published author. You should check out his website. He says, never read the Jeter, Schneider, and Mr. E book. It's an odd hole in my history of seeking out John K. Schneider III's work. I loved this guy since I received his Jekyll and Hyde Classics Illustrated when I was far too young. Now, I want to mention this specifically because after seeing John K. Schneider's work, where I don't know where I first came across it. I don't remember. But I was so blown away by John K. Schneider's work, I actually sought out that Jekyll and Hyde Classics Illustrated. I bought that thing too. And the whole reason I bought a Classics Illustrated comic was because John K. Schneider had done it. That's how much I liked his work. So good. It says, Timothy Hunter does look like a total douche in his portrait here. Sadly, that's probably his peak as an interesting character. The Books of Magic ongoing was criminally dull, proving not every bespeckled owl-befriended boy wizard is equal. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate that, Nicholas.
Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog says a bunch of stuff, including, it's interesting that Rob said Dave McKeon wasn't great at sequential storytelling. I would say the same is even more true for Chris Bachalo. Yeah, that's shocking. So many pages of his Marvel Mutant art is impressive at a glance, but I can't tell what the heck is going on from panel to panel. Again, he's great at pinups. The Kathy George piece is great. She was half a day late for her parents' murder because she was having sex in the field. She must have been well knackered.
Well, Martin, I certainly respect your opinion, and I appreciate you sharing it, and I adore you horribly, but, you know, you like cluck lore, so I don't, your opinion only means so much. Love you. Mean it. All right. And then we hear from Symbol Pending from the Symbol Pending Power Girl blog. Symbol Pending says, like Shag, I was going through my goth adjacent phase. I love that. My goth adjacent phase being really into my Sandman and reading in Black Orchid in one of those UK comics I've mentioned elsewhere. And he says, I'm sure you're sick of it by now, but a good issue as usual. Oh, well, thank you. Appreciate that. They are from Captain Entropy, who says, were you ever in a group conversation where one person really had nothing to offer, but would pipe up with a tangential point whenever he could just feel to be included? Well, it's happening again. I think it's a reference to how I had intimately knowledge of every single entry, and then you were just kind of like, the art's nice. Yeah, I don't know who this is. For the eight times I asked you, what'd you think of Shane? Anyway, Shag, you pronounced Homa correctly. A real place, by the way. Lovely people, delicious food, sportsman paradise. You pronounce things correctly more than you think, and the rest of us actually know how things are pronounced less often than we pretend to. We've all formally agreed not to tell you. He goes, you know what? Forget I said that. I don't need more legal trouble from Siskoid. I can't believe I actually said – see, I thought I said Huma, not Homa. But either way, I'll take the win. Thank you so much, Captain Entropy.
Tim Price from the Outcasters Bado podcast and the Batgirl Huntress podcast says, I'm not really into dark fantasy and didn't go through a dark, dark, dark phase, but I'm familiar with more of these characters than I expected. I was buying Kupperberg's Doom Patrol and just went right into the Morrison case and stuck with it to the end. Oh, I forgot. Love the table read idea. Please make this happen. And if I can help out, if there's room, I can do a wide range of voices. Mephisto, Neron, Nabros, PJ Frightful, you name it. Tim is talking about the table read idea I had, which hopefully we'll be able to do this summer. We're getting closer to summer, but hope springs eternal.
Yeah, I don't want to make any promises on when it will happen, but it's going to happen. Let's put it that way.
Okay, fair enough.
Then we're from DC Dave, and he says, a testament to Robin Shag, I didn't have an interest in these characters in 1991, and I still really don't care about them. And despite an initial ugh and a desire to just skip the issue, I was immediately drawn in. You guys are great in another great episode. Thanks. Aw, that's incredibly kind, DC Dave. Thank you so much. Then we're from Philemon, who is the president of the Jericho Fan Club. Coincidentally, he is the only member. Philemon says, well, it took 2 months and a long car trip with nothing better to do, but I finally worked up the motivation to listen to this podcast. No offense to y'all. You did an admirable job as always, but none of these characters, or at least these iterations of them, spark my joy. And then he says, okay, I'll make one concession. Shag did a good enough job selling it that if I've ever had to go into a COVID-induced quarantine and I couldn't find anything else worth my time, I would consider reading some issues of Shade the Changing Man. You should try it, Rob. It's good. Let me know what you think. Then we heard from Stella from the Batgirl to Oracle podcast and Required Reading with Tom and Stella. She says, I was startled with an inaccuracy about the three witches. You had mentioned that they take different forms depending on the culture of the viewer. The error comes in you saying or reading that they could be the Fates or the Furies. Both of these are entities that existed in the classical world of Greek and Romans and serve completely different purposes. For it to make sense and be accurate to the culture, the three witches could never have been both of these at any one time. If a Greek or Roman character were seeing them, they would see the same thing. I imagine it was the creator going a bit crazy on the three women and culture theme, but not thinking it through doing the research. Man, Stella just served Neil Gaiman. That's impressive. So well done, Stella.
And finally, Robert Markham says, is anyone impacted by the lack of Atari Force entries in the Zoo Omnibus? Me either. The outfits of Mr. Element and Mongol are still miscolored. Brown instead of green for Mr. Element, azure instead of purple for Mongol. The index mixed the Batman of Earth 1 and 2, and the names of the post-crisis Superman are that of Earth 1. But otherwise, this book is perfect. Who else has started listening to the Zoo podcast all over again with the Omnibus?
Oh my gosh. that would be fun to go back and do. I still love the first episode because we recorded it three times. So I feel like we were pretty sharp on that one.
Finally get it right.
All right, folks. Up next now, we are going to cover Zoom's Who. This is Zoom Yukinori's addendum to the definitive directory of the DC Universe. Zoom drew a lot of characters and did a lot of fake Who's Who entries. Unfortunately, we have covered all of the ones that were existing characters in DC at this point. There's still more to go, though. So, Rob, why don't you tell about which one we're going to cover today?
Yeah, this time we're talking about an entry called Kid Lantern. This was published on September 6th, 2012. The line had just drawn number 105 about superheroes getting new sidekicks. It was based on the news that Spider-Man was going to be getting a sidekick. So Zoom came up with his own character called Kid Lantern. And, it's okay. Let's get right to it. The secret identity of Kid Lantern is Hideki Isamu. And Isamu is the name of Zoom's son.
Woo!
One of his children, I should say, not just his only child. But here he's turning his son into a Kid Lantern, a kid sidekick. Now, Green Lantern did have, one of those, imp sidekicks.
Prody? Or it wasn't not Prody? Prody.
It wasn't Prodi. It was, I don't know, it was called Quibi or something.
Itty. Like that. I think it was exactly Itty.
What it was. But yeah, but here he's got a straight up Kid Lantern sidekick with a costume and a ring and the whole bit. And so this one is, I mean, gives the origin and everything. We won't get into all of it. You can read it on the website and, of course, in the downloads that we talked about. But this one is entirely drawn by Zoom. This is all original artwork, obviously, and it's again a testament to the man's astonishing creative powers that he could mimic these other styles and sort of blend his style in with these other artists that he was mimicking, and then do something like this where he's drawing it completely original and it's totally as good as all the other ones. It's just fantastic. The Kid Lantern drawing is great. He's got this great pose where he's kind of like rearing up and got his ring blessing, and then we see him taking on Sinestro, finally along with Hal Jordan. We see him getting trapped in a sort of death trap. We're seeing in his secret identity. I mean, it's just marvelous. And even the logo is kind of a gloss in the classic Green Lantern uniform. I mean, it's just, I don't know. We've completely run out of superlatives for this guy, how good this stuff just continues to be. And, I don't know. Every so often, I actually pull out my my Zooms Who book and just leap through it, and I just shake my head like, this guy, man.
And this one's kind of special in a couple of different things. In addition to Isamu, you know, this was 9 years ago, and now Isamu's aged quite a bit. He's a friend of the show now. So, yep. I mean, it's, you know, he might even be listening today. I don't know. If he is, I'd be interested to know, was Green Lantern your favorite character when your dad drew this? I'm interested. And the other thing that this entry has a special place in my heart is because of this entry, our world came into touch with Zoom's world. This is how we became friends. He did this entry for The Line It Is Drawn. And people reached out to him and said, oh, wow, you did this great thing. You should check out this Who's Who podcast. So then he listened to our show, and then we became friends. And it's because of this Kid Lantern drawing. So this is the glue that brought us all together.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, folks, yeah, it'll be on our gallery. And again, you should download Zoom Who if you don't have it already. Or if you're one of the lucky few who have the paper copy, you should flip it open, give it a read. It's really great. So, all right, folks, right now we're going to thank all of you at home. Thank you so much for those of you who shared our show on your social media timeline. I'm talking Facebook or Twitter here. And yes, this does sound like a long list of names, just like a phone book. But we want to recognize every single person who helps promote the show because it gets the word out there. And again, with the omnibus too, people are looking for Who's Who. So just stumbling across these posts, it really helps raise the profile of the show and bring in new friends, it helps this community grow. So let's say thank you, Rob.
Yeah, our thanks to Al Girding, Alejandro Araya Olivaria, Andre TFG, Andrew Lorenz, Ariel B, Batman-Suicide Squad Comics and Movies Facebook Group, Between the Pages Blog, Billy Delicious, Boca Contra Todos 12, Bud A, Canadian Geek, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Chris Lydon, Chuck Rodriguez, Coffee and Comics, Dale Russell, Damian Druitt-Whiter, David S. Gutierrez, DC Comics Vault, DC in the 80s, DC Officialista, Dr. Ange, Dragon PTY, Dr. Pop Culture BGSU, Ed Moore, Geeks Menagerie, Green Lantern HG, Gustavo Huguero, Hero GM02, Into the Weird, It's Plastic Man, J. Jones Goldstein, Jeff Polier, Jeffrey Brown, Joseph Kimbler, Justice Trek, Carl Disley, Con L., Larry Bailey, Lizanne Oswald.
Also, thanks to Magazines and Monsters Facebook page, Marcel Borges, Mark Jones, Martin Gray, Matt Ev, Matthew Barton, Max Reads Comics, Max Romero, Max Traver, Michael Kramer, Michael O'Brien, Mick Jameson, Mike A. Fitzgerald, Mike Dinas, Old Bolty Neck, Oscar Marin, Pablo Fontenez, I'm sorry, Pablo, Paul Hicks, Paul Kean, Prairie Justice, the Greg Sanders Vigilante Podcast. Just love it so much. Pulp Ticker Tape, Relatively Geeky, Rolled Spine Podcast, Salvador Hernandez, Sam Lowe, Scott X, Sean Ground, Sean Ross and the Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Sydney Dias, Siskoid, Steve Givens, Steve Wines, Ted Killington, The Mirror Factory, Tim Price, Waiting for Doom, Warlock Thanos Podcast, Warlord World, Wayne Soares, Willie Yarbrough, and Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast. Woof! Thank you so much to all of you for being part of the Who's Who family. We sincerely appreciate your support, and thank you from the bottom of our hearts.
Absolutely. And of course, you will be able to see a bunch of images from this website, from this issue over on our website, finewaterpodcast.com. Just check for the gallery post.
Awesome. Now, we are going to have some more special episodes of Who's Who coming up, but next time that we tackle an actual issue, it will be Update 93. It'll be featuring characters like
Abracadabra,
Agent Liberty,
Black Mask,
Black Condor,
Eclipso,
Azrael,
the Green Lantern Corps,
the Heckler,
Lord Satanus,
Legionnaires,
Timberwolf,
Valor, and many more. So that's going to do it, everyone. Please check out all of our social media, Facebook, Twitter, FW Podcast, Firewater Podcast, all that jazz. Go to our website, firewaterpodcast.com. Go to the Who's Who page. Leave your comments there. And that's going to do it. So, Rob, we finished another iteration, edition of Who's Who. This is amazing.
Wow. I remember when we started this, and it felt like it was a really long trek to do all 16 of these. But we did it. We
finished. Yay! Awesome. Well, thank you so much, everybody. Until next time, who's next?
Next.
Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC Who's Who. Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Arisia and Woozy Winks.
Hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC Who's Who.
Oh, man. We forgot Slipknot.
What's he think he's doing? Batmite may be an all-powerful being from the fifth dimension, but he's not a god, or more importantly, a network programmer.
Someone's got to stop him. This sounds like a job for Ambush Bug.
But first, a word from our sponsors.